Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Jim, can you tell us about the Freedom of Choice initiative that you went to school under in North Carolina?
Freedom of choice was a last-ditch effort on the part of white schools. It was a phenomenon that happened all over the South. Schools had been resisting since the 1954 Brown versus the Board of Education decision. White schools in the South and elsewhere had been resisting integration. Under freedom of choice, theoretically, any member... A member of either school system could attend the other. This was intended to encourage a token integration of the white schools. The assumption was that no white students would elect to go to the black schools, but maybe a handful of black students would elect to go to the white schools. And this would satisfy the courts, and integration then would stop at that point. So we, in North Carolina, we had 2 years of this Freedom of Choice program, in my county, 1966 and 1967, the school years that started in the fall of those years. It did indeed succeed in a very token level of integration. We had three black students in my class. I think there were maybe a dozen in the elementary school that I attended, which would have been something like 200 students. But very quickly, the courts ruled that this was not what the Supreme Court had in mind when it ruled that schools had to be integrated. They said giving students a choice in many regions of the country does not break down the barriers between the two school systems, so you have to go ahead and fully integrate. So 2 years later, the counties, my particular county, filed its plan for integration. It was approved by the federal judge who happened to live in the county. And at that point, the middle schools and elementary schools were integrated, and 1 year later, the high schools were consolidated and integrated. So within over a four-year period, I went to four different schools, all public schools. And we had the same phenomenon in Jones County, North Carolina, where I grew up. As soon as full integration came along in 1968, the first segregation academy opened, you know, which was flabbergasting to me. Here were farmers and white people who wouldn't spend a nickel on nothing, but all of a sudden, overnight, could find the funds to open a school. You know, I can't tell you the extent of cheapskatery in Jones County is still phenomenal. And the notion that they could, within a three-month summer period, find housing, find teachers, and find equipment for a brand-new school, just it still flabbergasts me. And there were dozens of these that opened in that same time period all over eastern North Carolina. So that when full integration happened, between half and two-thirds of the white kids went to private schools, and the rest of us stayed in public schools, making us a minority. I think the public schools in Jones County were 70% black and 30% white for the rest of the time I was there.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, January 7th, 2015. So I have been told. I know folks are still dealing with the humongous loss of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. The information that I've seen, latest information, that there will be a memorial service this coming Saturday. That's January 9th, this coming Saturday. It'll be on the campus of Howard University. And it's going to last for hours. So if you are in the D.C. area or think you will be able to be there by this coming Saturday, Memorial Campus of Howard University, and then there will be other memorials later in the month, I'm sure later in the year as we proceed, but most immediately this coming Saturday, folks can check. I think the Facebook page has more information if you are needing further details. We are fundraising for the month of January, starting the new year, get things in order. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. PayPal button is in the top right corner. Thanks again for everyone who has invested, supported us over the years. Hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. That said, our broadcast for today, one of our investors, frequent caller, Lashes, she sent me a video. You heard a snippet from the whole conference that took place, or at least that discussion at the conference that took place that happened in 2014. It was a Southern Literature Conference, and one of the authors that was present in the clip that you just heard, they were talking about the experience of quote-unquote school desegregation, school integration in North Carolina, and his experience as a white child during this period in the 1960s, and what that experience taught him, still, I guess, teaches him about the system of racism, white supremacy, what it means to be a white person. I know we've talked about that quite a bit, even doing a whole study session on the Little Rock Nine. It should be linked if you want to see the full discussion. There was another author present, also a white woman, talking about what happened in Prince Edwards County, and we have talked about that a lot on this program, even though that's in the state of Virginia, where they actually closed the schools for 5 years. Very important piece of history as well. But the book that we're going to discuss today, How I Shed My Skin, Unlearning the Racist Lessons of a Southern Childhood. Fascinating book, fascinating metaphor in the title that I'm sure we'll get more detail about as we roll. The author of the book and our guest for the program, he is a professor of practice in the English department at Emory University in Georgia. He is a prolific author, has won many awards, and actually has written quite a few pieces that directly deal with racism. Joining us live, our guest, Mr. Jim Grimsley. Mr. Grimsley, you're with us, sir?
Yes, sir, I sure am. It's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for sharing a bit of your Thursday evening with us. I guess before we get started, anything that you think it would be important for our listeners to know about who you are, the work that you do?
I think you pretty much summed it up. I am a novelist and playwright. This book that I just published, How I Shed My Skin, is my first venture into nonfiction. It's a story that I've wanted to tell for a very long time, which is to detail the years 1966 to 1973, when I was part of the generation that integrated the schools in Eastern North Carolina.
Right on. I think I've already said, but you are a white man, is that correct?
That's correct.
Right on. This program, and you being a professor of English, we have great respect, appreciation for words and definitions here. The terms racism and white supremacy, I use those as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
Yes, I certainly do. It pains me to say so, but I think that's a pretty thorough and complete definition. The only thing I would add to it is that this is their goal, whether they are fully aware of it or not.
Okay. Is it your view that there are a significant number of white people who are not aware that this is what's happening, racism, white supremacy, that white people are supposed to be dominating non-white people, and if you are a white person, you not only are you supposed to believe in that and get the goodies from it, but you are supposed to be helping to make sure that that continues on into infinity. Do you think that there are a significant number of white people who they don't understand this?
A simple answer is yes, and the reason I would say that, I would go back to the Martin Luther King quote that I can't quote it verbatim, but where he talked about the real problem in white America is the silent white racist, the white racist who gives in to the system without fully participating in it, meaning there's a huge number of white people who don't participate in active acts of hatred and bigotry, and who for that reason consider themselves not to be racists. My contention is that they are racists. The fact that we are racists, people of that ilk, people who are quietly racist, are probably a larger problem than people who are active and conscious in their hatred. So, for what it's worth, that's what I think is the biggest problem among white Americans, white people in general.
Okay. This is a point that comes up a lot on the program, and I take the position solidly that you cannot be a white person and be poorly informed or unaware about racism, white supremacy, even if you are not out telling nigger jokes all day long or doing direct acts of violence or what people would say are direct acts of racism, hanging a noose on somebody's door, things like that, that you still are very aware about racism, white supremacy, what is expected of you as a white person. And I would submit are most likely, I don't know how it would not be the case, still participating in direct acts of racism, white supremacy in other ways, whether it means denying a black person a job or seeing that this black person doesn't get to go to this school, they don't get to get a loan, these types of things. White people are participating and observing these things happening all the time. And even if you're just a white observer of all of this and you don't do anything, in my view, you are directly participating in the system of white supremacy. If you're white, you're seeing this happen and you're not intervening, calling the news reports, the police, or what have you to report this abuse that's happening, you're culpable, you're guilty, you're practicing racism.
I think you're right. I would not argue with that. I think you're right.
Right on. One of the questions I've been trying to ask as many white people as we can when they come on the program, this is an article, and it was published by a non-white person, but that notwithstanding, it was in a major national publication, The Atlantic. It was right at the end of 2014. The author was talking about racism, and he had a specific sentence where he was talking about white people, and he said, white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism, but rarely are they pained enough. And the question that I've been asking white people that come on the program, the first part of that sentence, do you think that that is a truthful, accurate statement that white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism? Do you think, a sizable number of white people, that statement is true?
Yes, I would agree with that, yeah. That fits my experience of especially white people I knew in my community when I was growing up and white liberals that I've known over the decades since. But I would also agree with the second part of the statement. They're not pained enough. One of the phenomena I see among white people all the time is that I'm not a racist thing. The thing that you talk to any white person, they'll say, well, I'm not a racist. I wasn't raised to be a racist. And I think that's almost, whenever I hear that statement, there's part of me that says, no, I really don't believe that's true. I believe you are a racist. I believe all white people were born into a racist system, absorbed racism into themselves, and enable racism in some fashion, whether it is with complete passion and hatred, or whether it is by passively standing by and allowing it to happen.
With the part about white people often being sincerely and greatly pained by racism, the white people that you've been around, and again, he's stating this generally, so like it's a sizable population of whites that would fit this. How do they specifically demonstrate that they are greatly and sincerely pained about racism?
They, in historical, most of what I've seen is a matter of I'm pained by an individual's racism. I mean, I am pained by the suffering of an individual black person, for instance. And I'm not talking about myself. I'm talking about the white people that are being addressed in this sentence that you've said. Genuinely pained by the suffering that they see in front of them, but somehow not making a connection to the fact that it is far more than a matter of one or two black people suffering. It's all black people suffering. It's all people of color to some degree, suffering from a system that is designed on a world level to keep them in their place, to keep them under the boot, as it were.
Okay.
People are very complicated. I mean, they can feel, in fact, some people like to feel that kind of guilt and pain, but they can all, they're also completely able to dissociate themselves from it at the same time. I mean, even during the era of slavery, there were genuine friendships between black and white people at that time, but that didn't stop the white person involved in the friendship from making sure that the black person stayed within the confines of the slavery system. As I said, people are very complicated. It's very difficult to make any statement about them that's just simple and linear.
We do make an effort to try to make sense and be logical, accurate, truthful about this very difficult, complicated subject matter of white supremacy. And one of the things that I try and do in terms of just being logical and even your response in terms of white people being greatly pained, to me, it's not logical. And it even goes back to the first question that the previous question that I asked about whether or not white people are ignorant about racism. And if you're white, you're very aware. It's not just one black person here or there that I'm sad that Dr. King was killed by this white man, or I'm sad about Michael Brown or Sandra Bland. If you're a white person, you're observing black people, non-white people being mistreated in great number every day in a variety of different ways, whether it's my parents are doing it, I'm doing it, my neighbors, my friends, we're swapping nigger jokes. I mean, this is all day, every day, all around the world activity. And to me, it does not make logical sense to say that white people, and I mean, to state it generally, we're not even talking about a subset, to make it seem as though there are a significant number of whites who are really upset about racism being practiced. And then I would still look for the evidence. What are they doing as a result? And I'm not even clear that I got a clear example of what exactly, how that's demonstrated, white people's demonstration that they're greatly pained, because I see really no evidence of white people doing anything of any substance. If they're really upset, they're really greatly pained about this, to stop this from happening, I just don't see that. And also for folks that are listening in, most of the white people that we brought on the program and asked that question, most of them have acknowledged that they don't think that that statement is true, that most of the white people that they've been around, that they've encountered, they are not greatly pained about racism. They might whine and cry on occasion when something has happened, a police shooting or whatever the case may be. But generally speaking, no, they are not. Most of the white people have said that white folks are not greatly pained about racism, just for the record. But people can come to their own conclusions on that one. Moving to your book, How I Shed My Skin, Unlearning the Racist Lessons of a Southern Childhood. What was your goal, your purpose for writing this book, and why did you pick this title specifically, How I Shed My Skin?
My purpose in writing this book was to tell the story of how I came to realize that I had internalized a great deal of racism as a child, and the impact on my life that came about when I started to have direct experience of black people, and to talk about the transformation I underwent through from about sixth grade to the end of high school. It's meant, what I wanted to tell was a story of my learning to cope with my racism, my attempt to recover from racism. I would not say that I, in fact, lost my racism. What I would say was I became very aware of it. I learned how deeply internalized it was, and I did, as a child, attempt to move away from it, still with the realization that what had gone into me so deeply could not ever be really eliminated. The title came about, the original title for the book was Good White People. The notion that I was trying to talk about in the book was that within the community of white people, the body of white people, that's a better way to say it, most white people would point at a certain set of white people and say, those are the racists, I am not the racist. What I was trying to do was to tell the story of the fact that it was, in fact, good white people who taught racism to me through their behavior, through the things that they said, through the way they had shaped the world. So what I'm really trying to do in the book is to try to get other white people to see that this stuff is in us, that we are more or less immersed in it. We are totally immersed in it, and that it's only by actually seeing that it's there and admitting that it's there and ceasing to deny that it's there that we can make any kind of progress.
Okay. I'm sorry.
The title is meant to embody that process, the shedding of this artificial skin that I was born with. You know, whiteness is a fictional creation. There is really not a separate race of people called white people. That's something we made up, basically, to justify what we were doing when we began enslaving black-skinned people. And that's the sense in which I meant that title to operate.
I know. Someone I knew pretty well used to say, race is a reality. You said a few times, you know, that you using this book to trying to examine your own life and the way that you were reared, inculcated with these racist ideas, and that, you know, right. You tried to examine them and get away from them. But, you know, to be honest, you still have a lot of this with you that you're working through. Would it be accurate to say that you, Jim Grimsley, are a racist?
Yes.
Okay. That I encourage our listeners consistently. Metaphors are very important in terms of just watching the way that metaphors are used, particularly when we're talking about racism. That's when I tell people their antenna should really be up, another metaphor. And I saw the title, How I Shed My Skin. It gave me pause for several reasons. I think, number one, frequently when people talk about racism, particularly especially when they're talking about white people, it gets very focused on pigmentation or the lack of pigmentation and quote-unquote white skin. And I consistently emphasize that when we talk about white, we're not really in essence talking about a biological grouping. We're really talking about a political category where people who are classifying themselves as white, and what that means is exactly what I said, dominate, terrorize, subjugate individuals that we say are not white. It's loosely kind of based around biology, but most of this is just, hey, I've said I'm white, people agree that I'm white, and right. We're supposed to dominate the planet, the universe, the world. And the second pause that I gave with the title, if you are racist today, 2016, then you have not shed your skin. This would just be examining your racism or examining your skin, if you want to stick with the metaphor. But I've just seen consistently where white people, when they talk about racism, even if they're talking about themselves, it's distancing from I am racist and not just being clear, upfront, right to the point about that. I'm racist today. I'll be racist tomorrow. I'm acknowledging it. I'm trying to work on it, I guess, or doing whatever. But that's the case. It'll be I'm a recovering racist or recuperating racist and these other terms to minimize and downplay their identification as, yes, I am still racist man, racist woman. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that is, in fact, what I tried to say in several passages in the book, that this is not something that you can get rid of. This programming goes much too deep. It is something that you can learn not to act on. It is something that you can learn not to be ruled by. But even if you do that, you're still going to be a white person within a system of white supremacy. I mean, even if I don't classify myself as the most superior race in the world, a member of that, then that, you know, my saying that I don't believe that myself doesn't really help anything, because the system is still there. It's still in place. It still benefits me. It still hurts people who are, you know, defined by that system not to be white. So, you know, but it's what I can do. It is the thing that I can do that will make some difference, at least in myself.
Hmm. You, at the beginning of the book, you talk about, it seems like you were a pretty avaricious reader as a child. You rattle off some of the titles of different books that you were reading back then. One of the authors that you mentioned, Robert Heinlein, hope I'm saying his name correctly, I have read some of his work, and we even did a program some years back with a different white author who writes sci-fi for children. And he too said that he grew up and he loved Robert Heinlein and read a lot of his books. And we had him on the book that we read, or the book that I read of Robert Heinlein that we talked about, Farnham's Freehold.
Yeah, I would have guessed that.
Why would you have guessed that would have been the one?
Because that's the book in which he writes about, I can't remember whether it's a parallel universe, but it's a universe in which black people hold white people in slavery.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting book. It's not one that I came across until I was probably in my 20s or 30s.
Okay. I remember in that this white guy, like, there's a nuclear bomb that goes off. He's in a shelter. They have a black servant with him. He has his whole white family with him, and they have their black servant, and they're going to this different universe and seeing all this stuff. And he has this long, eloquent passage where he's like, where black people are in charge. And he's like, oh my God, this is horrible. Yeah. This is the worst thing imaginable. Yeah. If there's ever going to be a universe with people in a civilization, white people are supposed to be in charge. Like, oh my God, what is going on? And we talk about, do you see, because you've read more of Mr. Heinlein's work than I have. He's revered. He is looked at as one of the, like, highest figures in sci-fi. Is that correct?
He's one of the great authors of what most science fiction writers call the Golden Age. He's got he has another strange book in which a man's brain is transplanted into a woman's body. And it has some parallels to Farnham's Freehold in terms of the man adjusting to being a woman. Heinlein is a fascinating kind of flawed writer. He's not somebody that I still revere, but he was certainly somebody that I loved as a child.
I am sure many white children did, and that whole sci-fi genre, that's what brought us classics like Planet of the Apes and some others that deal with racism, white supremacy, in my view. You talk about your environment. I thought one of the phrases that jumped out to me, this is on page 70, where you were just talking about growing up being a white person. In fact, I'll read a little bit so people will have context. Where you're talking about some of the surroundings where you lived at, and there was this family, I guess they had an airplane, they were really wealthy, and I guess some years back their white family had enslaved black people, and you said that you'd never given it a thought. You said, but I hardly blinked at the thought that the same family had once owned slaves. I did not remember a time when this fact was new to me. It was part of the background, something I had learned earlier than memory. And I thought that was a profound way of putting it. Just if you could give us a bit more detail when you say you had learned this earlier than memory, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, when white people tell, especially white Southerners, when they tell stories about their families, when they tell stories about the old days, they make reference to slavery very, very casually. You know, the particular house that you mentioned was a plantation house, and the outbuildings next to it, I remember driving by it, and I don't remember the first time I heard that those were the slave cabins over there, but I heard it so early that I never felt any surprise about it. And I learned, you know, at that point, slavery was just a word like farmer. I didn't understand the implications of it. And in fact, I wouldn't understand the implications of that fully until I actually began to meet and associate with the black children who lived in the county, for whom that word was an enormously loaded term. I mean, one of the refrains that ran through those years of integration in the school that I attended was, you know, slavery times are over, was one of the things the black kids reminded us of whenever there was any kind of verbal dispute. And that's when I saw their outrage at having been held in this kind of bondage, that's when I began to understand what it meant, or at least began to understand some of the dimensions of what it meant to have been treated as a race in that way. But even then, you know, what you realize at 13, you think you know something then, but it's only when you're an adult and you begin to really study these ideas and issues that you actually begin to make any kind of contribution.
You give some great detail about your training as a racist white supremacist in East North Carolina growing up 1960s, later 1960s. This is from the chapter appropriately titled The Learning. I want to read a little bit, if you will allow me, from page 78, kind of two pages starting on 78, but I just want to give the quick nursery rhyme that you start the chapter off with. Nigger, nigger, black as tar, stuck his head in a molasses jar, jar broke, nigger choked, and went to heaven in a little rowboat. Turning to page 78, you write, I played with cousins at family gatherings in Rocky Mount, where my father's family originated, or in Princeton, where my mother's people lived. The rhymes were ubiquitous and attached to the supposed innocence of play, taught me their lessons through the medium of fun. Learning them in the shadow of the church or in the pine-shaded schoolyard, knowing their acceptance by the adults around me, meant that the word was acceptable at least to a degree. Women who might have objected to the casual use of nigger as a word on the grounds that it was not nice, nevertheless accepted it in the guise of a child's rhyme. A child might be corrected for calling someone a nigger at the wrong time or place, or using the word in a sentence in polite company, but adults might not object to the chanting of an old rhyme in the yard during a game of jump rope. The doggerel was a part of play. Adults in that era told nigger jokes in which the theme of inferiority played out in many ways, generally involving the dumbness of Negroes who often mistook one word for another or one process for another. I would hear my father tell these jokes to my uncles when they were out of hearing of their wives, or else I might hear them at a country store or a service station, places where men talk to other men. The jokes usually involved the nigger getting instructed to do something simple and making such an obvious mistake that the result was hilarious and embarrassing, and the joke served as proof that niggers were never very smart and got even the simplest facts mixed up. When we laughed at the joke, we accepted the premise. Learning about blacks shaped my expectations. What I observed about black people was meant to fit the frame this word created inside me so that I would see what I was supposed to see. The space of nigger, once prepared in my head, would resemble the same space in the heads of all the other children who played with me and the other children with whom they played. It was a word that organized the world, and we began to learn it at the same time that we learned to speak and walk. The word was used in many ways, always for the same purpose, to reinforce the association between nigger and anything bad. When my father was angry at my mother, he would accuse her of being part nigger. People who danced too much with too much hip movement were doing nigger dances. Something that smelled bad smelled like a nigger. Clothing that was too loud or colorful was like something a nigger would wear. Putting on deodorant rather than bathing was a nigger bath. A house where a black family lived was a nigger shack. A white person with thick lips had nigger lips, and a person with kinky hair had nigger hair. An unruly child might be called wild as a nigger, while a slothful adult was as common as a nigger or as sorry as one. Certain kinds of flamboyance, like a penchant for lawn ornaments or a taste for bright colors, were described as niggerish. If a house fell into bad repair, it was a place not even fit for a nigger to live in, a truly terrible abode. If food was particularly poor in quality, it was something even a nigger wouldn't eat. A stopgap or sloppy solution to a repair problem was a nigger rigging. In all its uses, the word had a nasty, bitter edge, and as a child, I heard the scorn and placed these feelings alongside the word till in its final form, it embodied a little of everything bad. I will stop there. Thank you for your publishers for getting me a copy of the text. Just can you describe why you included that portion of the book with so much detail in terms of what you were hearing as a young child at the time that you were learning to speak and walk?
Because I have heard so many white Southerners say they never used that word, they never heard it used, it was not a common word, and I wanted to give enough evidence to really just blow that claim out of the water. It was a word that I heard used casually, commonly, by a large number of people. When I was working on this book, one of the first things, when I would tell a white person that I was writing this, one of the first things they would often say to me is, you know, in my house, we were not allowed to say nigger. And my answer to that was, well, you know, your mama also probably told you not to say other cuss words, but you probably said them anyway. And what your mother was really talking about was not, she was not trying to enlighten you about race issues. What she was trying to do was to teach you how to speak politely, because that was not a word that you would use in church. That was not a word that you would use in genteel female company. There were politer terms for black people that were used in those particular settings, but none of that belies the fact that this was a very common term among white people when I was growing up, and I don't see how this can have been true for me and only for the people that were around me. I just don't think people are telling the truth when they say they never used this word or they never heard it used.
I would agree. Just the context of the statement, in terms of you could say these nursery rhymes at church or in the schoolyard, the one that I read at the very beginning of it, hearing uncles, your father passing nigger jokes, some of the examples that you gave I'd heard before, some were new to me. I emphasize consistently the monumental importance of these racist jokes, nigger jokes, these little ditties. Those are huge in terms of communicating what it means to be white and how you are supposed to view black people in particular. They are gargantuan in transmitting racist culture and should not be just, you know, scoffed at and laughed at. And particularly when I compare I just do not hear black people invest all this time making these type of jokes and comments about white people. I just have not experienced. I'm not saying it doesn't happen at all, but I mean, this seems to be like a really common thing amongst white people, and I don't see that amongst other groups of people and how they talk about whites, particularly given everything that's happened. I try to ask our guests, particularly white people who talk about racist jokes that they've heard and what have you, if they can share any that they remember, because I really make a point of deconstructing the jokes and what they're saying to really get to the subtext. Are there any jokes that really stand out to you that you recall hearing in your childhood?
Honestly, it's been probably 40 years since I heard a racist joke. But, you know, all the jokes that were told about niggers were the same jokes that were later called Polack jokes. You could substitute nigger for Polack very easily. But unfortunately, my memory, you know, I'm 60 years old now. My memory's not that good even for jokes that I like and want to tell. And I've not really remembered any of the uglier or more evil jokes.
Hmm.
I wish I could, but I can't. You know, I don't. They're not in my memory now.
Right. You, and this is not in the book, but in the talk that you did that was recorded on C-SPAN from the Southern Literature Festival, you commented about your nieces and nephews, and it seems like at least some of these traditions have continued. Can you speak to that?
Well, one of the reasons that I felt that it was important to write this book was when I began to understand that my nieces, my nephews, my cousins, my second cousins, these attitudes were being shared among their generation. You know, there was a time when I heard one of my relatives use the N-word, and I had to use the word nigger, and I just had to stop them. Other times when I heard assumptions being made about black people, you know, the black kids at school are lazy, the black kids at school are this or that or the other. And I realized that this teaching was still being handed down from one generation to the other, that the pervasiveness of it, it might not be as open as it used to be. You know, I can't really tell whether that's true because, you know, by the time I noticed these things as an adult, I was also speaking up about them. So my family got in the habit of being careful around me, but that doesn't mean anything had changed in terms of the way they were thinking. So that when you actually do start speaking up about racism, you may think you're actually making a difference, but actually you're only teaching your white friends, oh, this person has this attitude, we can't talk like that around him, and they're perfectly willing to make that accommodation.
Very important point, try to get that across. And even I would submit it goes back when you were talking earlier about sometimes you had white people that were enslavers and they were quote-unquote friendly to black people. And I submit you can be a white supremacist, a white terrorist, and be nice or polite or display courtesy to a black person. I won't call Bob nigger, or maybe I will be nice. I will, you know, bring them something to eat and have pleasant conversation and not say anything bad about them. However, I'm still white. I'm still racist. Right. I still know this black person's place. Even if I'm not calling them a nigger, I know that their place as a black person is supposed to be well below mine forever. And I thought that that was really important, even in terms of your mom, where you talked about, I think you asked her why you shouldn't say nigger. And she said, you know, it's not polite to use that type of term. It's just not, you know, it's just not a courteous way to speak. That doesn't mean that she is not racist. It just means that we're going to be a bit more refined about how we go about doing this and not just being as crude and nigger this, nigger that, blah, 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 the way you want to function as a white person. I think that is hugely important. The nieces and nephews, the current, I think that's important too in terms of these are current young, because people say that all the time, that younger white people are, once the old folks die out, once we don't have George Wallace anymore, once we don't have Paula Deen anymore, all of this problem will go away. And I think that is utter nonsense as well, that you're just saying a refinement. Maybe they listen to black music and that sort of thing, but they are still dedicated to making sure white people are in charge. On page 97, I thought this was hugely important as well. I think one of the concepts that I use on this program consistently is the religion of white supremacy, and thinking about this practice as a religion. This is a little bit forward in the book on page 97, where you write, "God himself ordained that black and white people were unequal and were never to mix in any way. He made this stipulation in order to preserve the unique purity of whiteness. Like the Israelites of old, we were his chosen people, and the world he had created belonged to us above any claim that others might have on it. I understood all this from such an early age that I cannot recall when the lesson began, but I can be relatively certain where the lesson began: during church, listening to what was said by adults either from the pulpit or in the yard, mixed in with lessons of obvious virtue." Moving down just a little bit further, this is on page 97, "The process of teaching that defined black as the opposite of white continued far beyond the walls of the church. That opposite became one of the patterns that enabled me to sort through the world. From television, I understood that good cowboys wear white hats while black guys wear black ones." Can you just kind of discuss the central role that church played in teaching you these lessons about white supremacy?
You've read the central part of what I wanted to say. We're it's not just in church, but in the English usage in general, black is the idea of blackness is a bad thing, whether it be in church or in literature. You know, going into a time of darkness, the notion of dark humor, black humor, humor that's based on negativity, the notion that sin is a blackness on the soul, and that if you are redeemed, your soul is washed whiter than snow. These terms were hurled at you from the voice of God in church, and so it felt as if this were the way. You know, this was a process of defining the way to look at the world. I mean, I went to church from the time I was 4 or 5 years old. I didn't attend it steadily, but I didn't miss so many. I attended it steadily for a few years when I was a young child, and then during the years from about 9 to 16, I went to church constantly. And these ideas about black and white were just laid out as if they were, well, not as if they were, they were laid out as the Word of God. That blackness is the enemy of God and whiteness is the color of God. And that, you know, I'm a fairly intelligent person who learned to be skeptical of that when I started getting a better handle on the world and reading more widely and becoming more educated. But people who don't take that step, people who stay within the confines of that philosophical system, they're going to, to my mind, that's the reason that the relationship between white people and black people is so uniquely oppressive and antagonistic in terms of the way white people treat black people. It's true that white people are in general oppressors of non-white people, but white people have always reserved a special enmity for black people, for the people we defined as black people, above and beyond the way that other races were treated. And I think that comes from the black-white dichotomy that was taught to me from the pulpit in church.
Context of white supremacy. Also on page 97, you said, you wrote, "My lessons in racism therefore came to me as part of my training in goodness." I process that is, if you are a good white person, if you are a good Christian, a good religious white person, you're supposed to be practicing racism, particularly making sure that you keep black people in their place. You wrote pretty honestly in talking about your family in developing in all of this. You submitted that you think it's possible that your white father could have participated in acts of direct violence against black people in East North Carolina. Do you think that's possible?
Oh, yes, I do. I know that these were not stories that were ever told to me. And in fact, most of that kind of, the only thing I ever heard about white violence against black people was told to me by black people. My father was the kind of man who would have run with the Klan if it were active in Jones County. I am told now that it was active in Jones County, but I never heard anything more than rumors about its activity when I was growing up there. It was dangerous. By the 60s, it was dangerous to talk about people doing that kind of stuff because the legal system no longer supported it as openly as had been the case a few decades earlier. So, you know, there were rumors that the Klan met in a particular place in our little town, but nobody ever verified. Even today, I've never been able to get anybody to verify that these meetings actually took place or that violence actually did happen in the county. I've heard of one incident of a Klan ride through the county. But again, the historical documentation for that is basically oral history within the black community. The white people still don't talk about it, don't want to talk about it. They don't want to know what happened.
Wow.
They don't want to own up to their responsibility for it, obviously.
Pattern. Just geographic information. How far rural part of East North Carolina, Pollocksville, how far was that from Wilmington?
Well, it would have been about between 1.5 to 2 hour drive to Wilmington.
Okay. We've been talking about some of the incidents that happened there, the Wilmington 10 and the white terrorism that happened right at the end of the 19th century where they drove out a lot of the black people. We've been talking about that the past few weeks as well. You have, actually, before I even get to Manny's sister, because I thought this was an important lesson as well, you are a professor of practice. At least that's what it says on your faculty page for Emory
Right.
University. What does that mean exactly? What do you do as a professor of practice?
What that means is I do not have a graduate degree in writing. I have a bachelor's in English. And I have been hired to teach as a writer there on the basis of my publications. In other words, on the basis of my practice of writing. It's a distinction that academia makes between professors who are tenured with terminal degrees, teaching degrees, and people who, like me, are hired into non-tenured positions.
Got it. Appreciate the clarification. So Manny's sister, this is an incident that you tell a little bit later on in the book. Manny is not a black person, at least it didn't come across to me that way in the book. His sister didn't come across to me as a black person either, but there was a problem with you associating with her. Can you kind of share what happened with our listeners?
These were kids who had brown skin. I would guess that they had some kind of Hispanic, Latin, or maybe Native American heritage. They were not dark enough to be sent to the black schools. I mean, Manny was one of my classmates, but they were not white enough to be as good, quote unquote, good as I was. That's the message of this incident that I told. I spoke to Manny's sister in front of my father's refrigeration store, and a woman across the street took great exception to my speaking to her and literally rushed out of the store across the street and shouted at me across the street to leave the girl alone and go back inside and not talk to her anymore. And of course, this was humiliating for the girl and embarrassing for me, and I refused to go in, but she never came out to talk to me again, and I never spoke to her again. This was one of the signs to me that this notion of black and white, this notion of white supremacy was as virulent as the racism that was practiced against black people was, white supremacy was even larger than relations between white and black people. White supremacy was a total worldview. It wasn't just about white and black people. It was about white people being the best and having to stay away from any kind of association with any person who was not lily white, who was too brown in some fashion. It's also a sign of the fact that whiteness is a fictionalized construction. There was no clear demarcation. I mean, if Asian people had settled in Jones County, they would have come to the white school, even though they were clearly, in our minds, not white people. You know, it's a sign that there's no real clean separation between what we call a white race and the rest of the human race, not to the degree that white supremacy wants you to believe.
I
hope that was clear.
Definitely. I thought that segment was important for the reasons that you just laid out. But again, for me, it further evidence white people are not ignorant about racism. If you're looking at people that closely to say, well, wait a minute now, this person is not quite a black person, this isn't a nigger, but still, they're not quite white. So, yeah, we can't be hanging around with them either and having a code about right. this where this gets passed on. And one of the other points that I bring out consistently, because I also think this is hugely important, if you are a white person and you make an error, you make a mistake in terms of what you are supposed to be doing, how you're supposed to behave as a white woman, white man, white child, other white people will let you know, hey, okay, you are not supposed to be doing that. Were you going to respond?
Right. Yeah. That's absolutely true. You know,
hugely important when people bring out the white ignorance about racism, because if you were a white person and you were messing up, if you worked at a bank and you approved every black person that came in for a loan, you hired all black people, I am certain other white people would intervene immediately to let you know that this is not how things are supposed to be going. This is right. not what you're supposed to be doing. And I've just seen right. too much evidence of that globally. Skipping to the book before I nab some of the folks that called in. This is, I think, a pivotal moment in the book. I think that was corroborated when I heard your talk on C-SPAN, where you mentioned this moment as well. So you're at the school, you start out, you give some very interesting anecdotes about first being at school and the first time that three black children are there in school and how that kind of went down. And then they're supposed to be lumping all of these children in together. And I played the audio clip where you had a sizable portion, I think you said between maybe 50% and maybe 2/3 of the white children went to the private academy, and the rest of you all were in school with the black children, and so white people were the minority in terms of population in the public schools, and you're part of Eastern North Carolina, so it's a lot of black children, and you still have gotten mostly white administrators. I think that's what came through in the text. So this is on page 149, or wait a minute. Yes, we're on page 149 in the book, and make sure I get the correct portion. I'm actually going to go back 147 and read over. We'll do it that way. 147. One day, matters came to a quiet peak. I was working with Evelyn Hall on a display for the bulletin board. We stood at the back of the classroom, lettering signs and cutting words out of construction paper. My white classmates were snickering and making some remark about what would happen once George Wallace was president. Quick history tidbit, George Wallace, former governor in Alabama. I think he had his famous moment where he was keeping black people out of one of their major state institutions, and just he was champion of white supremacy at the time. He ran for president 68, I think. Back to the text. They were talking within their own group, but making a conspicuous show of it, a performance for the rest of the class. This was one of the moments when Mrs. Ferguson was absent from the classroom. Evelyn Hall turned to me and indicated the huddle of white boys laughing about the return of segregation. "You see your people, don't you?" she asked. I said, "Those are not my people." I kept working quietly on the bulletin board. She took in my answer and said nothing more herself. And you described this as a defining moment for you in your childhood. What was the significance of this moment for you?
When I told her those were not my people, what I meant was I don't stand with them. I don't believe what they're saying. I don't want to be part of that. So this was my first moment of consciously, that's the first time I publicly and consciously said, I am not going to be that kind of white person. I can't, you know, and that was, at that age, that was the best I could have articulated. What I meant was, I'm not going to cause you a problem the way they are. What I see in it, when I look at that in the context of my whole life, that was the moment when I realized that this thing called racism, this thing called white supremacy was active, and that if I was going to try to get rid of its influence in myself, I was going to have to stand up and do that publicly. I couldn't do it by keeping silent. I couldn't do it in any way except by declaring it.
I found it fascinating because this moment, just looking at the text, and again, you as a English professor at Emory University, a distinguished institution, I pay attention in reading. I pay attention to the way things are structured and the sequencing of things, what's connected in terms of events, how things go from one event to the other. So you give this pivotal moment. You say it's a definitive moment in your childhood. And, you know, coming to terms in terms of your identity. And I am not just going to passively accept all of this white supremacist teachings that I've, you know, had from day one before memory. From this, the next sequence, picking right up, same page. This, though, does not equate to erasing the ideas about skin color that was so deeply ingrained in me. I accepted equality, but I still feared walking past groups of black boys in particular, and I still dreaded confrontation with the anger of the black students, an anger I could see on their faces as they watched us in the classroom. I no longer acted on notions of my superiority, but the idea that I was superior failed to disappear. In truth, at that age, I thought I was superior to almost everybody, regardless of skin color. As for Stephen, this is a black male student, as for Stephen, he tested me in a different way. I had been watching him a bit too much, I suppose, for he turned to me one afternoon during our English class and caught me staring. He asked in a loud, clear voice, "Do you want to suck my dick?" The question shocked me a bit, and the words hung over the classroom, everybody watching me. Time slowed for me, but I knew I had to respond with as little hesitation as I could manage. I answered, "No, I don't," knowing that I must not show any surprise, outrage, or fear. I spoke calmly and looked him in the eye. I have no memory of blushing, but I suspect I did a bit. "Are you sure?" he asked. "I'm sure," I said, "because you keep looking at me." "Well, I still don't want to." I shrugged and said nothing further. What the other students made of the moment, I have no idea. There was no laughter that I recall, meaning at least that if there was, it must have been minimal. I showed no embarrassment, and to my credit, I suppose, I felt none. Nor did I fear being exposed as queer to the rest of the class. He might have an instinct that I was a sissy, but he had no proof of what was inside me. I had never breathed a word of what was in my head. No one had anything on me, so I could face Stephen down with only a moment of panic. Still, I was more careful in the way I looked at Stephen after that, even when we became friends in later years. I will pause there. What is the importance of this moment, and why is this the immediate event that you list after this definitive moment of saying that, you know, these are not my people?
I wanted to make it clear that I'm not presenting myself as any kind of a hero. What I'm presenting is a process by which I became more fully aware and more fully human. So when I told, there are so many narratives written by white people in which white people present themselves as heroes of racism, if you understand what I'm trying to say. And I wanted to make it clear that that is not at all what I'm trying to do in this book. And so that at this moment when I had an epiphany with the young woman at the bulletin board, I wanted to make it clear that that didn't finish my process of growing, that it only began it and or continued it in a more conscious way. And the next moment when I tell the story of, I forget, you have to remember these are not the real names of these kids, and I can't, was it Stephen that
yes,
I
sir.
Named that character?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. The moment with Stephen was a moment in which I was being challenged in a sexual way, and he must have, you know, I am gay, so he must have felt that in some way, or maybe he had heard some kind of, maybe he'd heard the other boys calling me a sissy and wanted to call me out on it, but it was clear to me that he was testing me in some way when he caught me watching him. And he was a very good-looking young man. I was actually probably attracted to him. So that moment was a very complicated moment when I was not simply being confronted about my whiteness, but also being confronted about, you know, are you a queer? That was kind of the question that he was asking. And he was asking in front of the whole class. The teacher wasn't in the room at the time, as best I recall. So that was a moment when I realized that no matter what my feelings about anybody in that room, my first instinct had to be to protect myself and to keep my secret.
Wow. When I processed that, particularly as I said, the sequencing, because I think that's really important in terms of, you know, you have this definitive moment where you reject these racist white students, say they're not my people, and then it transitions to this, and especially now getting the information that you shared about not wanting to just write another book. And I do understand what you mean about the white hero, where they get to be redeemed even if they are racist, and now they're no longer racist, and, you know, they're doing whatever they're doing. They have, you know, freed some black people or adopted a black person or whatever. Often, I would even say it's they end up in some sort of sexual arrangement with a black person. In fact, I talk about all the time on this program how so many people say that's how, and I mean, they present this seriously frequently, that that's how we're going to end racism. Once we get enough black people and white people in bed together and they have children, then that'll, you know, take care of this problem, or that this gets submitted as proof.
Yeah.
That I am not racist because I have been in a sexual relationship with a black person,
right,
or I married a black person, or, you know, whatever. And in my view, it's even as you said, it's not very far from me. I just view this is just another act of racism, white supremacy. I think there's a long history of white people sexually exploiting, sexually manipulating black people, and even black people, black males, black females, and black children, having to endure a lustful white gaze. And I think you did admit in the book that you had been looking at Stephen. You thought he was attractive, that you had been kind of looking at him longingly for a while. I could totally see a black person being upset about that. Like, why is this person looking at, particularly regardless if it's a gay white male student or if this is a heterosexual thing, being upset about a white person that's constantly staring at me. We're at school. They don't even want us to be here. You got these white people that are making comments about the South will rise again and all these racist remarks. And then you have white people that are leering at me. I could totally see a black person being upset about that. And for me, it just It very much sounded like enacting a white person practicing racism and how black people, all of us, males and females, consistently get overly sexualized in the system of white supremacy. What would your response be?
Well, I would go back to what I said earlier. This, again, I was trying in writing this book to be honest about the whole process, the whole ups and downs of these years in terms of how I became aware of my racism and how I started to deal with it. I think you've pretty much nailed what that moment meant, and I don't really have any other comment about it. I was more afraid of myself than I was self-aware of that moment, afraid for myself in terms of being outed as a gay person. But I can certainly understand why Stephen confronted me the way he did. I don't think there's anything I don't think I can say anything other than that and be honest about it.
Context of white supremacy. Again, our guest, Mr. Jim Grimsley. Last question I'll get, and then we have listeners who I think want to ask some questions as well. You have another great anecdote. This is later on in the chapter, No Longer Separate, Not Really Equal. We have a black teacher at this point. This is high school years. The name that you give in the book anyway, Betty Murphy, a black female teacher. And you say, hey, I'm gonna challenge her. I'm gonna call her by her first name. And, you know, she immediately responds that is totally inappropriate and you will not address me in this manner, kind of putting you back in your place as a student. And you move forward where you are reflecting after this moment. You eventually apologized to her for doing this and, you know, everybody moved forward. But you wrote, this is at the bottom of 164, as for me, I learned that some part of me would test the black people around me, would bully them, would disrespect them, unless I took hold of it in some way. I learned that this behavior could take the form of an impulse that I would not fully understand until I acted on it. I was a functioning young bigot, a sneaky one who might act only occasionally from this side of myself, but who nevertheless had the impulse. Another profound passage that I thought in the book. Can you kind of describe it in the context of this moment and what that revealed about yourself?
I can't describe it much better than I wrote it. I just thought it would be funny to call her by her first name, or at least that's what I thought I was thinking. My total thought had to have been bigger and uglier than that, because you know, that was an occasion when, as soon as she called me out on it, I understood exactly what I had done, and I understood that I owed her an apology for it. But even further than that, I understood that, you know, the fact that I was becoming friendly with black kids, the fact that I was becoming, you know, a little bit unpopular in the white side of the classroom because I was so friendly to the black side of the classroom, that didn't make me a good person. That didn't make this problem, this white, it didn't mean that my training in bigotry was short-circuited. In other words, it meant I had a lot of thinking to do, and at that age, I was beginning to be able to do it consciously. What I understood that dealing then was that dealing with racist impulses, when you think you have your mind in the right place, becomes a matter of searching yourself even more deeply and understanding where your impulses come from, understanding the things that you might do that you think are accidental, but that when you do them are going to feel deliberate to the other person. That's when I began to understand how deeply complicated this whole issue was and how thoroughly ingrained my training in racism and bigotry already was. As I say elsewhere in the book, I have no idea what kind of person I would have turned out to be if I had not gone through. If I'd gone to a white private school, I am fearful that I never would have seen any of this stuff. That I would have gone on to become a full-fledged bigot. You know, one of the people that I see now and recoil from, because that is what I was trained to be. That's what my environment wanted me to be. I was supposed to be one of the people who upheld the system of white, black and white separation in the region where I lived.
Mm. Again, just for listeners, I really try to emphasize accuracy with terms. This is about a lot more than quote-unquote separation. This is about white supremacy, white power to dominate, abuse, subjugate black people. Black people and white people were not separate on the plantation, but you had a clear differential of power in terms of who's in charge and who's being abused and terrorized. Do you think this is pretty widespread? Do you think this is applicable to white people as a collective, that white people collectively have some part of them where they will test a black person that's around them and will bully them and disrespect them? Do you think that that's applicable to the white collective, generally speaking?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, I don't think there's any question of that. I have so many people I know, friends who've told me, you know, I'm tired of white people asking me if they can touch my hair or touching my hair without even asking, you know. Yes, absolutely. It's. I would say that it's almost universal among white people.
Mm. Would definitely agree there. Do you, just with the term of categorizing this as some sort of white supremacist, racist impulse to challenge and abuse a black person, the categorizing that as an impulse, to me, it almost suggests that there's no thought to this. I think you also used the term accidentally in there as well. And I'm curious about that. Like, if we want to look specifically at the moment with your teacher, Betty Murphy, or just more generally, do you think that's an accurate assessment of what's happening? This is an impulse. This is something where there's really no thought, no forethought, that this just happened, almost like a reflex of racism.
No, there was certainly forethought in it. What I meant by what I said was that it was not an action that I had deeply... I didn't sit there and think, I want to embarrass this black lady and teach her that I'm better than her, because I wouldn't have known what to do with that thought if that had come to me. What I mean is, it's an impulse that I had not fully examined. That's what I meant by accident.
Hmm.
Because certainly I understood after I had done it and after she had challenged me on it that I had done it deliberately. But, you know, human beings are very complicated in the way that they do things, and they don't always do them with a fully conscious sense of what they mean. That's more or less what I'm trying to say there. Because by this point, I didn't really think of myself as... I thought of myself as evolving away from racism. So I think, in fact, the fact that I thought that made me careless, you know, made me forget that I was... or made me ignorant of the fact that I could still commit acts of bigotry, acts of white supremacy. So that's what I mean. I accept your characterization of it. But again, I know that I did not sit there and think, I'm going to teach this colored woman who she really is, because I wouldn't have allowed that kind of thought into my head at that point. But there was some part of me that was, in fact, doing exactly that.
Hmm.
Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
I'm
really not trying to let myself off the hook. What I'm really arguing for here is that this was not something that, as a 15-year-old, I had fully examined and was fully aware of.
Hmm. I hold that in one hand, what you just said, and then on the other hand, there is a long, undisputed record of white people deliberately not addressing black people by their correct names, or not calling them ma'am, sir. You're going to be, I don't care if you are a 100-year-old black female, you're still going to be Betty. I'm not going to call you Mrs. whatever your surname happens to be if you're married. None of that matters. So you'll be aunt this, even though we're not related. There's such a long history of that sort of deliberate discourtesy and disrespect and this being done in a really demeaning and racist manner purposely by whites, and even a record of white people being upset when people are referencing black people as sir, ma'am, getting upset. What are you doing calling that nigger sir? What are you doing calling that nigger ma'am? This is a disgrace. It's very difficult for me to accept that. I mean, if you had been 9, 8, 6, maybe I could, but I mean 15, that's, you're pretty funny. You said yourself, you were looking at the news and stuff at this point. You all are debating about who should be the next president and what have you. Is it going to be Nixon, George Wallace? That, it's difficult to accept that this was not thought out in some way, or I was distancing, or that sort of thing. It's difficult to accept that as being completely true.
Well, it certainly felt to me like a very ugly moment when I looked back on it. An ugly moment for me, an ugly moment in terms of my behavior. So I guess in essence I would say that you're right.
Mm. We will check in, see if folks have any questions based on what they've heard or anything else that popped in. I would encourage folks to watch that talk that was on C-SPAN, because you pointed out a lot of good stuff there. And the other author is a white female, Kristen Green, if my memory serves, where she was writing about the same type of subject. Can check it out. Thanks to Lashes again for sharing. The person that dialed in, I guess you're on the VOPE line. Did you have a question for Mr. Grimsley? Your line should be open. Caller on the VOPE line, are you with us? You have your mic muted or what have you? Not hearing you. I'll check one more time and then we'll get the next caller. If you're on the VOPE line, you have a hand up. Did you have a question for Mr. Grimley, or are you just listening? I will check in with them as we roll. Check back before we wrap things up. Different caller, caller in Canada, I believe. Did you have a question for Mr. Grimsley? You should be with us.
Yes, I do have one question for Mr. Grimsley. In light of what you've seen, you know, what you've observed about white behavior and what Gus said about distinguishing between the fact that what black people are dealing with, it's not about separation, it's about white people exhibiting their institutional power against us and their white supremacist violence. Do you think, in light of this, that it is wise for black folks, seeing that these behavior are in young white people, and you've seen this in your time, and you've said you've seen this behavior among your nieces, and you've seen this recently among children and teenagers, do you think it's wise for black people to assume that integration, particularly in educational spaces and in workplace areas, should try as best as possible to avoid, to informally, I guess, avoid integration with white people?
True.
Why or why not?
That's an enormous question, and I can't really, you know, in light of the conversation we're having tonight, I don't think I could claim that it's safe for a black person ever to open themselves to a relationship with a white person. And yet I've had some extraordinary friendships with black people, with, and I'd be very sorry if those hadn't happened. So I think what I would say is I'm grateful that people are willing to expose themselves in that way when they are, but I can't say they should or they shouldn't. That's not my place. I can say that I'm aware of the dangers, and if it were my choice to make, I don't know what I would make.
Did that answer your question, caller in Canada?
Yeah. Yep, that answered my question.
Okay. The caller, MC Gusto, I guess, if you had a question for Mr. Grimsley, you should be with us.
Good evening. I have a couple of questions. Sir, do you, comparing white people from the 50s and 60s to the white people of today, as far as racism, practicing racism goes, do you think there's a difference? Has it gotten better or worse? And if so, why?
I would say that it's changed to the degree that the practice is no longer fully supported by the law and the state. I think in some places the practice of racism has probably lessened, but it hasn't disappeared. But I don't, you know, I'm feeling this conversation tonight very deeply. I'm not sure if I'd even say it has improved at this point, because I don't think the system of white supremacy has essentially changed. I think it's adopted new tactics the way it has all along since it was first begun. So, you know, I think to the degree that white people, you know, I don't like to hold myself up as any kind of a great example because I've, you know, I'd still call myself a racist, but I know that I have tried to erase the parts of it that I can erase from myself, and I've tried to be honest in my dealings with people about it. And I hope there are more people like me, but I don't see altogether convincing evidence that white people are better.
Okay, my second and final question is, I typically see that white people, when they want to get something done politically, militarily, any type of way, scientifically, whatever, and they really set their minds on getting stuff done, they get it done. If they want to get it done, if they have the intentions and the will to get it done, they get it done. So I have a question, I guess a hypothetical question. Let's say you wanted to end the system of racism, white supremacy, and you had the power and the authority to do that. Let's say you had all executive, legislative, and judicial power, whatever powers you had on the world or a country, whatever. What would you do if you had the will to do so? What would you do to end the system of white supremacy? What laws would have to be in place? What type of what would you do if you had that power?
If I can assume that I'm able to do whatever I want to do, I suppose what I would do is develop some kind of process by which every single white person could be confronted by the actual real process of their own white supremacy and not let up on them until they saw it and regretted it and ended it in themselves to the degree that they can. I mean, I'm not sure anything other than people looking at their own hearts in a true and sincere way is going to change anything. You know, I've talked to a lot of people since I published this book, and a number of white people have told me that this is only going to change gradually, and you know, you're never going to, you going around and getting people to read your book and talk about your book is not going to help anything. And you know, while I know at one level that's true, I also know that if everybody actually looked into the mirror and saw these things in themselves the way I've seen them in myself, it would make a difference. So if I had the power, I would lay bare everybody's heart to themselves, every white person's heart, and make them confront their own heart and the consequences of their own actions and their own beliefs. And if that didn't change them, I don't think there would be any hope for change. Because laws aren't going to do it. They never have done it. You know, being in the same room with people of other races hasn't done it. So I don't think anything but a confrontation with, you know, there are huge consequences to white people to behaving the way we do. We become heartless. We become inhuman. We become monsters. And I guess I hope that if there were some way actually to demonstrate that objectively and undeniably to people, that that would shake them up to the point that they would at least start to alter their behavior and start to open up their systems, our systems.
So you think
that's the answer I can give you.
Okay. So you personally think that, I guess, revealing, having their racism being revealed to themselves, so I'm assuming that they're unaware of their racism, that would make them regret
they're
it?
They're not unaware of it. They're in denial about it. You know, a person who's in denial knows what they're denying to themselves, but they just go on being in denial about it.
And you say to that, well, what would your answer be to that, Dan? How would you, you know,
you have
counter
to,
that?
When you find somebody who's in denial, you've got to shake them out of the denial. You've got to intervene. You've got to have an intervention.
Any like
you
a therapy
have to pin
session?
Them down
or,
until they, pardon?
Like, in what ways would you say that, though? Like therapy or, I mean, force, physical force? Like, what would you say to, how would you shake them down?
I'm not an expert in those areas. The interventions that work are somewhat therapy-based, so I suppose I would do that. And the people I know who are doing, there are groups I've heard of who are doing some work that they consider at least to be meaningful along these lines. There's a group in Durham, the name of which I can't remember right now, but I talked to a woman who ran that group, and she talked about how carefully community interactions that actually want, in which people actually want to discuss racial differences between people, had to be set up and how to manage them. And it sounded to me that she was on the right track, but it, again, since I'm not a psychologist and I don't have a lot of faith in legislating, I don't know what else to say other than what I said. You know, I don't have the magic solution.
Hang tight, caller. I want to make sure we nab as many folks as possible here. The caller at 4231, last four digits, 4231. Did you have a question for Mr. Jim Grimsley?
Yeah, I had a question that I wanted to ask. The first question would be, do you think that the day of judgment is real, whether that be for individuals at their particular time or for a group?
Are you speaking in a religious context?
No, I'm just asking a question. Or yeah, it's in. I guess that would be in a religious context.
This phone is just, I'm about to lose power on this phone. I wish I did believe that, because that would mean that at some future date, all the wrongs of the present world would be set right. But I don't know if I do believe that.
Okay. And then my next question would be, do you think that in the English language that the words humanity and mankind directly in some type of way mirror the whole conversation that we're having tonight, seeing that all of the brown, all the way extending to black people, would be humanity, consisting of color, and then mankind being actually Europeans or Caucasian, classified as white people. Do you see any thing that I see about that?
Some of your questions cutting out because my phone keeps beeping at me because the battery's dying. But I believe when the Bible speaks of humanity, it's not talking to white people, it's talking to all people. In fact, I don't think the idea of white people exists in the Bible. I think that's something that white people have imposed on the Bible. Are you still there?
I'm still listening.
Okay. And that's the best answer I can give you.
I guess on the phone end, is it, because there were a few more folks that had questions, if you're able, I'm sure they would love to get their question in promptly before you exited. Is it, I don't know, is it possible for you to switch lines, or if we could dial you on your cell line?
You can call me on my cell phone, which is fully charged.
Oh, okay. I will, caller, did you have another question, and then we can make the switch. Did you have another question?
Yeah, I guess I want to sneak in this final question since we did kind of go into how Christianity kind of helped influence the racism as far as the concepts about white and black and all of that as far as the people are concerned. So I would ask, do you think that this is why Caucasians or whites or white supremacy is in direct opposition with a religion like Islam? Since they fundamentally teach the exact opposite of racism, white supremacy, and that racism, white supremacy cannot exist?
I think that's one reason white people cling to Christianity, yes, because Christianity tends to emphasize whiteness as goodness.
Okay. I will call Mr. Grimsley on his cell line and see if we can nab the other folks who dialed in with their questions. We can do that promptly. I'll go ahead and I'll hang up your house line, and then I'll just dial you right back on your cell line, Mr. Grimsley.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Hello.
All righty. Got Mr. Grimsley back, and we will move right to our next caller. I think this is Roz. Roz, did you have a question for Mr. Grimsley? Proceed.
Yes, Steve Garcia, Mr. Grimsley, and the callers. I had two questions. The first one kind of has a lead into it, and it's very short. I just wanted to ask, since white people at this time have planetary control over non-whites within the 10 areas of people activity, which are economics, education, entertainment, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, war, and healthcare. Would you say that those particular 10 areas of people activity function as the organ system of the body of white supremacy, and that white people collectively function as a white supremacist superorganism?
That's a pretty... I would have to actually contemplate that question for a while before I could even understand it. I mean, I think the answer I really can't answer that question. I haven't thought of, I don't really think in those terms. I think the answer is probably yes, if I think about it. But again, I haven't thought about the notion of white people as a superorganism.
Okay, because the reason I ask is just simply because the problem is a planetary problem, and historically, all people around the world have had hundreds and in some cases thousands of years of this sort of interaction with white people. So for that reason, that's why I asked if you would agree with that or disagree. My second question is... Oh, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I said I would probably agree with it, and if once you place it into some kind of historical context, as you just did, yes.
Okay, thank you. And my second question was, what was the age of the youngest white person that you saw or heard practicing racism?
Well, as I tried to say in the book, that I remember myself practicing it and watching other people practice it long before we were conscious of it. So I would guess, if you count those nursery rhymes as practicing racism, and you certainly should, then 3 or 4.
So my last question is, would you say that white people are born white supremacists, or would you say they're made white supremacists by their interactions with adults? And that's it. Thank you so much.
I would say made.
Okay, thank you.
The second of your propositions.
Right on. Appreciate that, Roz. I think this is Thomas in New York. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Mr. Grimsley?
Good evening, Gus.
Greetings.
Greetings. Greetings to all the callers. Greetings, Mr. Grimsley.
Greetings.
I have a few questions for you. Since you've been an adult in your adult years, have you been accused of being a racist?
No.
No, okay. How often is race discussed when you're around your white colleagues or other white people and no black people are around?
Within the last 5 years, it's discussed increasingly often. Before, in the 80s or 90s, being in a room with all white people was usually an invitation for racism to be practiced again, not to be discussed in any meaningful way. But in the years since possibly the turn of the millennium, and certainly since Mr. Obama's been president, I've had increasingly complicated discussions of racism with my family, with friends, with white people. I think it's important that white people do talk about this as an issue that's our issue, independent of any other people. Since this is something we're doing, we're the ones who really have to talk about it.
Okay, wow. Have you ever heard racist comments made by another white person and went back and told a black person what you heard?
Could you repeat that last part, please?
Have you ever heard, been in dialogue with other white people and they were making racist comments, and you went back and told a black person what you heard, or maybe not to trust that white person because you heard them making racist comments?
Oh, yes, yes.
Oh, you do? Oh, that's great. Wow. I have a few things about, I read a few articles on you, and Gus kind of touched on this. New York Times wrote, one of the most extraordinary passages in the book is the catalog of all the casual ways the N-word, nigger, was easily dropped around him in his early childhood, even by his parents, from racist nursery rhymes to racist similes, smelling like, dressing like, dancing like, hair like, and so on and so on. And Gus kind of read that passage. And you said you didn't remember any jokes. I'm sure, like most people and myself, you remember the nursery rhymes. Those kind of come back to you pretty quick. Can you share a couple of them with us?
The two that I could remember are the ones that I wrote in the book.
Okay, those are the only two you remember?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Gus read one.
Again,
you
I'm
the
60.
One that
you...
Excuse me?
Let me look in the book. Let me see if I can find it in the book here. Eeny, meeny, miny, moe, catch a nigger by the toe. If he hollers, let him go. Eeny, meeny, miny, moe.
Okay, okay, interesting, okay. My last question for you is an interview you did with Tamara Keith on NPR. And you had a female classmate, Donnie Meadows. She was also a part of the interview. And I believe you wrote about her in a book, but under another name.
Right.
And she made a comment that she was shocked that you had kissed her sister, who I would suspect is a black female. And you yourself commented that you are a gay white male. I just wanted to know, have you ever had sexual intercourse with a black male or black female in your course of living? And that's my last question. Thank you, Gus, for taking my call.
No, I've never had sexual intercourse with a black female.
I think he said male or female, black male or female.
I'm not usually used to talking about my sex life in these interviews, but no, I have not had sex with a black male either.
Okay. That is one of the the things that I encourage, Area 8 sexual activity, very important. As we already touched on, that's been a big part of the practice of racism, white supremacy in terms of white people sexually exploiting black people. Definitely encourage folks. Good question to ask when talking with a white person. The caller, let's see, the caller at last four digits, 4683, 4683. Did you have a question for Mr. Jim Grimsley?
Yeah, I just got one question for the guest. I want to ask him, you know, what is it that the white supremacists hate about black people?
There's no.
I mean, I know, you know, because it's some kind of hatred. It's some hate in the equation somewhere, right?
I know it's there. But yeah, what it is. Saying,
but you should know what it's about, too, though, huh? I mean, when y'all get together and y'all talking, what, how the conversation go? What did we ever do or what are we doing? That white people did.
You didn't do anything. What we hate is what we did to you. That would be my answer. What we hate is what we did in enslaving
you. We should hate what you did, right? But I mean, it's something about us that, you know, it sparked some kind of hatred in y'all, man.
To get that question answered, you'd have to really talk to somebody who's openly practicing his hatred and get him to answer, give you an answer.
I think all white people
crazy. Hatred.
I think all
yes,
of them
sir.
Crazy. You know, if it wasn't so, you know, we wouldn't be in the situation we in right now. We constantly watching little kids get killed by the police, unarmed men getting killed by the police, unarmed women getting killed by the police. You know, everything going on in this country, in this world right now is racially motivated. But, you know, the hatred is for the black people, though. You know, the people like to say people of color and all that, but, you know, the Asians, the Indians, don't none of these people wear like we wear. So, you know, we trying to figure out what's the problem, where the hate come from.
The hate comes from inside us, and I don't think it has anything to do with what black people are or what black people do. It comes from some kind of evil that we have accepted in ourselves. I don't know of any other answer to give you.
Yeah. Appreciate it, Gus.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I think this is Lashia. She's the person that saw the talk that you did on C-SPAN and recommended that we reach out, see if you'd be willing to come on the program. Lashes, did you have a question for Mr. Grimsley?
Hi, yes, I do. Thank you very much for taking my call. Mr. Grimsley, I have four questions, so please bear with me. The first question is as follows. Based on your observation, how is the practice of white supremacy different in methodology compared to white females and white males?
I don't really feel qualified to answer that question. That's not something I've. I mean, I think historically what you've seen is that the white male is the enforcer of the system, and the white female is a more passive instigator. But that's an oversimplification, and I don't really. Again, I'm not a scholar of this subject. What I'm trying to share is a personal story, and I really can't claim to answer that question articulately.
Well, I'm only asking that question based on your personal observations from, you know, being on this earth for how many years, just in terms of what patterns have you seen in terms of the difference in methodologies compared to how white females practice racism, white supremacy, and white males practice.
Sure. White men are responsible for the violence.
Mm-hmm.
White men are the ones who are expected to go out and perform the acts of brutality, to do the killings, to do the beatings, to do the rapes. White females are expected to provide the context for the white male to do those things. I mean, again, that's an oversimplification, but I think that's what I've seen to the degree that I've seen it.
Okay. So basically, like, a good analogy would be, like, for example, a basketball game, one team member, you know, preps the layup for the other team member to get the ball and place it into the hoop, so to speak, to gain the score for the team, so to speak, right?
That's a good analogy, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. My second question would be, would you consider white females as the cultural transmitter of white supremacy to their offspring?
I think they're part of it, but I think it's the totality of the community, in my case, that I saw transmitting this. In particular, the shape of the segregated facilities, the speeches that I heard at church. I think what you said is one very important way that racial information was white supremacy was transmitted in my experience. But it's only one aspect of it. It's the totality of the racist system that I think transmitted this information to me. It was everybody, okay, everywhere.
Okay. So would you say that racism, white supremacy is white culture?
That's a really loaded question.
Only because, like you said, it's more of like a community participation in practicing racism, white supremacy, whether it's embedded in the laws, the English language.
It's part and parcel with white culture,
economics,
yes.
Economics. Right, but all those individual areas encompass culture, a particular culture of a particular group. So that's the only reason why I pose the question whether or not racism, white supremacy, is white culture.
There is something essentially supremacist in white civilization and white culture, yes.
Okay. In current times, based on your everyday interaction or conversations with other white people, do you foresee Donald Trump winning the Republican ticket and or the presidency of 2016?
I certainly hope not. I don't foresee anything in the... Frankly, this country is in such bad shape right now that I don't know what's going to happen next.
Mm-hmm.
But my hope is that he is not going to end up being president, and I'm certainly not going to support him.
Mm-hmm. The only reason why I pose that question is because Donald Trump, seems to be implementing what's the South Carolina guy?
Ben Tillman.
Yes, Mr. Tillman's apparatus, but more updated for a 21st century, I call 3.0 style GDP.
Yeah, right.
So that's the only reason why I pose that question. And also, Mr. Trump appears to be appealing to whatever angst or anxiety or fears that white Americans do have at the current time, under the 8 years of the Obama administration, and my guess is that it's going to go in the hands of Republicans for 2016 due to the fact of the high purchasing power of guns, ammo, white fear, anxiety, the uncomfortableness, the not sure of XYZ. So that's the only reason why I pose that question.
I think he is the single candidate who has reminded me the most of George Wallace back in the 60s, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the country is much more divided, much more heavily armed now than the 60s culture was.
Mm-hmm.
So I've thought some of the things that you just articulated, that, I mean, I think a lot of my friends, especially my liberal friends, don't understand the extremes to which white people have gone to win elections in the past. And since Ben Tillman is a very good example of the lengths that people will go to keep black people from voting, for instance. So, you know, I'm not hopeful entirely, but I, you know, I pray that it's not going to be Donald Trump.
Just based on historical patterns is why I posed that question in regards
to... I think it's an understandable question. I think it's a very cogent question. I just don't have a good answer for it.
Okay. And my last question is, why do you think the media or film, TV, et cetera, is advertising more quote unquote interracial coupling on TV now than ever before?
Well, there are two ways to answer it, and I don't know which is true. One is that we actually have achieved a greater level of diversity. And the other is that we hope we have and we want to pretend we have. I honestly, when I feel good about the world occasionally, I feel like the latter. When I feel cynical about the world, I feel like the former. So...
Mm.
I mean, I think we desperately want to put forth an image that we are better now than we were 50 years ago, and definitely better than we were 150 years ago. But history isn't static, and white people are still essentially the same people, and we still see ourselves as running the world. We still see ourselves as entitled to that. And I don't see enough change there to feel comfortable saying that the world's actually gotten better along those lines.
So do you think such tactics as what the media is portraying currently now is more of white supremacy rhetoric towards its victims to think things are changing when they're really not, in order for the white supremacy cultural system to maintain its dominance and morph into a more sophisticated form of white supremacy? Like a soft tactic.
Certainly. You're articulating a very deep level of fear that I have when you ask the question that way, and I don't have any way to answer it except to say that your question touches a nerve, if you get what I'm saying.
It touches more of a what?
I mean, are we seeing progress or are we seeing a new form of white supremacy? I don't know the answer to that question. I think we're going to see it worked out in front of us. I think the answer is probably that both things are true at the same time. Human beings are incredibly complicated. History is incredibly complicated.
Okay, thank you for my questions.
Sure.
Right on. Caller in Michigan. Oh, wait a minute. The caller on the vote line, I guess she might be another one of our Canadians. Did you have a question for Mr. Grimsley?
Hello, may I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, good night, Gus and Mr. Grimsley. I do have two questions. Mr. Grimsley, based on your childhood accounts and discovering your sexual orientation, did you ever pursue a black man since Stefan? I think that was a character in your book.
No, I did not.
Okay. Last question.
I was sexually closeted until my mid-20s, so no, I didn't pursue any man.
Oh, okay. All right. Also, do you think that black people should be in interrelationships with white?
I can't. Could you repeat that question? It's not coming through clearly.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
All right. Do you think that black people should be in interracial relationships with whites?
Um, Yes, if they're in love with each other, if they actually can be open to each other, yes.
So you don't think it's in any way harmful, or there's like a power imbalance, or you don't think it's harmful to decolonizing projects and the strive for liberation?
I'm aware of the different arguments on both sides of this issue, but I'm not in the business of telling people who they should or should not have relationships with. When one person wants to try to be with another person, my feeling is that's their own business. You know, I don't believe that ideology should trump their need to be with each other. Go ahead. No.
No. You can finish your answer. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can now.
Oh, okay. She said you could finish your answer.
I said, I really had finished it. You know, it's. I know people who are in mixed couples. They swear by what they have with each other. They are honest about the difficulties that they've had with issues of power imbalance, both inside the relationship and outside the relationship. But if they say they love each other and they say their relationship works, no relationship is without problems. So, you know, I can't play God and say that they shouldn't be together. That's their concern. That's their fate. I don't have any business intruding on that.
Okay. Well, all right. A follow-up question to that would be like, okay, what if the white person in that relationship is not supportive of anti-racist work or anti-white supremacy work? Like, how would you think about interrelationships then?
If I were the person in that relationship, I wouldn't want to be with that person. If my partner isn't going, I mean, you're describing, if I understood your question correctly, you said, what if the white partner was not supportive of anti-supremacist work? Did I hear that correctly?
Yes, you did.
If I were that non-white person in that relationship with that person who didn't want me to work on any supremacist, I'd just have to get out of that relationship.
Okay.
I would say the same thing about any kind of relationship in which the difference in races results in the white person asserting too much power in the relationship. That's you can't have that kind of that's not a healthy relationship. Can't be.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your answers. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. I think we had two other people, and we'll have all our callers. Caller in Michigan, did you have a question for Mr. Grimsley? You should be with us.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus, to the callers and to your guest. And forgive me if you've answered this question. I've been having some technical difficulties with the line. So who was your target audience for your book?
I wanted to speak to white people about the racism I see in the white race. I'm perfectly delighted to have other readers, but my target audience was white people.
Okay. And my next question is, who do you feel is more confused about racism, white people or non-white people, and why?
White people. I mean, there's no question about it. White people develop a kind of, we don't want to see it. We don't want to admit to it. We don't want to, you know, to the degree that we can be blind to it, we're going to be blind to it. That's just seems to be who we are. So yes, we're, it's definitely the answer to that question is white people.
Oh, interesting. Do you think that it's appropriate for white people to adopt non-white children?
Again, I think that's the personal, yes, I have to say yes. I mean, I know people who have made very successful families out of, I don't think they should do that at the expense of black families. I don't think they should be allowed to break up black families so that they can have a baby. That's not what I would say is true. But I know enough people who have done that, who've made loving families, even though that has, there are probably tensions within the family, that I would have to say I wouldn't restrict that, no. I understand there are lots of people who would disagree with that and very good reasons to disagree with it, but you know, again, I can't play God and say that's not.
Okay, got it.
Are you there?
And my last question. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can now.
Have you heard? Okay. And my last question is, what do you suggest non-white people do to, I guess, protect themselves or protect ourselves from being mistreated from racist?
That's probably the hardest question anybody has asked me tonight, and I've had some hard questions. I don't know how to answer it, to tell you the truth. If you live inside a white-dominated society, I don't know. I don't know how you feel safe. I mean, you can't separate yourselves from white people far enough to be protected that way, and you can be hurt by mixing with white people. I mean, that's part of why this is such a monstrous issue to deal with. You know, the best thing I suppose you can do is live your life as best you can without reference to white people.
Very, very interesting. Thank you very much for taking my call, Gus, and thank you to the guests for answering my questions. I'll mute myself.
Right on.
Thank you.
Last caller, person at 2456, 2456. Did you have a question for Mr. Grimsley?
Sorry about that. Hello, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Nice to hear from you, Gus, all the callers and listeners. Also, thanks to guests for coming on today and talking to us and giving us more information about the system of racism, white supremacy. Person that came on the show today, I'm sorry, I forgot your name. I just have one question. With the white people that you know, what percentage of those white people do you think are in fear of white genetic annihilation?
I couldn't give a percentage because honestly, I don't, you know, I'm a college professor. Most of the people I know are not going to reveal any kind of fear they have along those lines. I don't hang out with people who are openly in fear of white genetic annihilation. And if I'd heard somebody speak about that, I'd have to tell them that blending your DNA with someone else's DNA is not annihilating you in any way. So, you know, I can't really give you a good answer. I know there are a lot of people who feel that way in the world, but they're not people that I associate with. And so I can't really help you with an answer.
Okay, and then, well, since you couldn't answer that, I want to ask one more question, if I may.
Sure.
Okay. How many white people that you know are comfortable with their lower percentage of numbers as far as being a global minority? Do you hear them saying that that makes them nervous, or that they think about that, and maybe that's why they act the way, or they have these behaviors the way that they have?
I think that's an excellent question, and my perception is that that's the reason that we're seeing such a rise in racial violence and violence of white people against black people now, is that we are beginning to see clearly that we're not the chiefs of creation, that we're not in charge, that we are in fact a minority, and a fairly substantial minority. And I do think that's why you're seeing the polarization, especially on the right end of the white political spectrum right now. In some ways, I think you can equate the number of people supporting the right-wing candidates with the number of white people who feel like that.
Okay.
I mean, I teach at a university that prides itself on its diversity, and yet we're still a majority white university. If you look at television, you see minority, you know, we even still use that word minority about people who are not white, and yet that is the majority, not the minority. I mean, the realization that the bulk of the world is not white, I don't think it's even fully penetrated into my consciousness yet, and I'm fairly educated on these issues. So I would have to say I'd say that's a fairly big player in what's going on in the world right now. I'd say that is a huge player.
I didn't mean to cut you off. You said you can't really fathom it in your mind, and you've been to universities, and you've studied us a lot, and you know that you are part of a global minority, but even in your mind, you can't fathom that. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying, I know that it's true, but I know that my predisposition is still, unless I am being vigilant to think about the world, you know, if I don't stop and think about a television series, I don't think, well, why is the majority of this cast white? You know, that's not representative of the world. So that's what I mean. I don't mean that I actively think that white people are running the world. That we should be, but I mean, I don't think. Yeah, I think my first statement was right. I don't think it has fully penetrated even to somebody who thinks about these issues to the degree that I do, who's white.
Okay, all right.
We have a very powerful old white mythology in our heads. You know? I mean, it's insane.
I agree. Thank you for coming on the show, and thank you for answering my questions.
Thank you for your questions.
Right on. And I think we nabbed all the callers. Before we let you go for the evening, Mr. Grimsley, I just wanted to ask, it was a big incident last summer. They had all the victories for gay marriage, same-sex marriage during, I guess it was the summer when they had the Supreme Court decision, was not a majority opinion. I think Justice Clarence Thomas, black male, he was one of the dissenters when the gay marriage decision came down last summer. And you were a Trekkie, you mentioned that in the book. George Takei of Star Trek fame. He spoke out. He's a gay non-white male. And he spoke out immediately and voicing his celebration, euphoria about the decision, another win for gay rights. But he condemned Justice Thomas immediately. He called him a clown in blackface. And then he waited a day to calm down, because this was like live on television when he made these remarks. So he waited a day, and then he calmed down and wrote this letter again, blasting just Justice Thomas. Justice Thomas, unless I've been misinformed, was not the only justice who dissented in this opinion, but George Takei singled out exclusively Justice Thomas, and he said that he labeled Justice Thomas a minstrel. And then called him a black buffoon. He said specifically that Justice Thomas was a white actor who blackens his face to play a black buffoon, and that he was not qualified to be on the bench. Do you see all of this around the gay marriage issue? And what are your thoughts on what George Takei said about Justice Thomas?
Well, I think it's appalling. I'd never heard that I'm not a big George Takei fan. He seems to, he doesn't speak for me in any way. He's an actor, and I don't think that qualifies him to be a spokesman. That's an appalling thing to say. Justice Thomas, regardless of whether I disagree with his opinion or not, has a right to his opinion. He's earned his place on the Supreme Court. He certainly shouldn't be singled out. I don't have hard feelings against anybody who disagrees with gay marriage. It's not an easy issue for people to accept. I am glad the Supreme Court made the decision that they did, but I don't agree with the gay people I know who vilify people who disagree with the decision. I think that's senseless behavior. So no, I think that's an appalling thing for him to have said.
After he calmed down after all of this, he eventually did apologize for the remarks that he made about Justice Thomas. But to me, it stood out just the anti-blackness of it all. I think in the system of white supremacy that is so powerful that he did not single out any of the other justices who also dissented and said that they didn't agree. He didn't have anything to say about them or their qualifications to be on the bench. It was reserved exclusively for Thomas. And for me, this fits a pattern where I've seen a lot of particularly focused on black people. If it sounds like one saying that black people are, there's something uniquely homophobic about black people. It seems like there's been a lot of that. And then if there are any black people who speak out and say that, you know, they don't support gay marriage or anything like that, they get attacked vigorously. Have you seen that? Have you heard that? Any of these suggestions?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. You get this notion that a black person who doesn't support gay rights is the wrong kind of black person in the gay community. And I think that, as you just said, that's just another side of the white supremacy card being played. It's white liberal supremacy. It's some variation of that. I have friends, it's not even just limited to the gay community, though. When I hear white liberals constantly say, why do black people vote for anybody but the Democratic Party? And I think that's another form of the same thing that you've just talked about. It's another form of that white supremacy thinking. It's just translated itself into different terms. You know, so, I've seen a lot of that. And I think it's disgusting. Mm.
Right on. The book we have discussed most of the evening, How I Shed My Skin, Unlearning the Racist Lessons of a Southern Childhood. Emory professor in the Department of English and admitted racist, Mr. Jim Grimsley, has been a fascinating exchange. We will definitely look forward to having you back on the program. Really appreciate having a white person who's willing to answer some questions and give their views on racism. If you continue, particularly if you're writing anything else on racism, we would love to check it out and love to have you back to continue the dialogue.
I really feel honored by having been on your program, and thank you very much for taking the time with the conversation.
For sure, for sure. Again, Mr. Jim Grimsley, thank you again. We will stay in touch. Please enjoy your evening, sir.
You too.
Thank you. Evening.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Context of white supremacy. Again, Mr. Jim Grimsley, thanks to Lashes for the recommendation. And I would definitely encourage folks to check out the C-SPAN video. It should be linked in the description if you want to see the one. You can see what Mr. Grimsley looks like. And then they actually discussed two books. I'm looking to get the other one because, as I said, it's about Prince Edward County in Virginia, where they closed the schools for 5 years. And so a lot of white children and loads of black children totally missed out on school. And the white author, I think her name is Kristen Green, suspected racist female, but she was talking about how her grandfather was one of the leaders in this movement to close the schools and all the other things that they did because they didn't want their little white urchins to be in school with niggers. But it looked fascinating. I got a copy today, and I'm going to see if we can get her on the program as well. But we have talked about that before, the Prince Edward County situation. We even had the documentary filmmaker. They closed the schools back in 2012, if memory serves, back at the end of 2012. But we had him on the program. He's in Virginia, and there's a book by pretty much the same title. I think it's They Closed the Schools or They Closed Our Schools. But it's a book by pretty much the same title written by a white man that we talked about in detail. And in fact, the white filmmaker, he said that the book by that title that came out to give the whole ugly history of what whites did. And just if you can imagine being a black child, you're five, you're supposed to go to school. They close the schools for 5 years, so you don't get to start school until 10. Or if you are, let's say, 13, right, you're in seventh grade, eighth grade, and they close the schools, they open schools back up, you are 18, and you haven't been to school since the eighth grade. You've missed all of, that happened for a whole county, Prince Edward County in Virginia, 5 years. And that's not the only place. That was an error she said in her talk on C-SPAN. They did this in Mississippi, too, although it didn't last as long. But they did this in a small area in Mississippi as well. And they just forget it. We won't have school at all for anybody if we got to go to school with niggers. But at any rate, hopefully we can get her on the program down the road. And we have done research on this before. I think gives a lot of constructive details about white supremacy, racism. Quick anecdote, and then we'll check in if folks have anything they want to share about what they heard on the program. I guess I'll give two quick ones. One, the importance of black self-respect. I'll save that for last. But the first one, he gives an anecdote, Mr. Grimsley, in the book about this white male student named Judah Carl, and this is around the time he's in like middle school, so this would have been like a 12-year-old, we'll say, white child, white male. Judah Carl, where he comes to school, and this guy is in a wheelchair, right? He's got a disability and all kinds of difficulties, really frail, and the whole nine. They have to adjust how they're going to have class because they have to take into account that, you know, this guy can't walk and he's in his wheelchair and all that. He comes to school in his wheelchair with a sign that's written that says, "I hate niggers." And they have to go take him out of the class and take the sign from him and all of that. And it just, all white people. You are wasting time, and it's simply a matter of not being accurate. It's not, you know, going out and cracker this, hate that. Just, we want to be accurate in our assessment. What does it mean to be white? Even the disabled whites, they didn't miss the memo. They know what it means to be white. They know what they're supposed to think about you, niggers. The second anecdote, Mr. Grimsley, and I think he's talked about this a lot, probably one of the highlights when he goes to talk about the book, but when he first is in middle school and they first do this quote-unquote integration and they bring in, I think it's three black students. I think they're all females, too, black females. But they bring them in, so they're in school with all these whites. And the teacher goes out of the classroom one day and he says, I'll get some, score some points with my fellow racist classmates here. And so he singles out one of the black female students and calls her, excuse the language, but this is what he said, calls her a black bitch in front of everyone. And instead of cowering or crying or running off, she turns around and says, so you're a cracker bitch. And there's like, oh, I can't believe she said that. So they're kind of looking and she says, I'm black and I'm proud. I love my skin. I love myself. And they're just stunned, like, oh my God, I can't believe this happened. And he said that it really stunned him because he thought that she would just, you know, be submissive and cower. I'm a white male. I'm a white supremacist, and she's supposed to know her place. And that is not how it went for me. It just, what Dr. Francis Chris Welsing talked about on a constant basis, black self-respect. And to me, it sounded like she had been properly prepared by some adults, even though certainly I would be in the camp of saying, this does not sound like a healthy learning environment at all. I would not want to be there if it was me, and I would not want my child there. But for the people who did send her there, it sounds like they at least did take some steps to prepare this child for what they were going to, what she was going to encounter in being around all these little racists, and to have black self-respect so that I know how they function. I know what it means to be white. I'm not surprised, as Thomas in New York said, I'm not looking for white validation. I'm not looking for you to be my pal. In fact, I'm waiting for you to call me a nigger so I can demonstrate my black self-respect in my response. Not that we need to name call white people, but I thought it was a great demonstration of the importance of black self-respect, where you can still function in that environment and not have white people immediately destroy you and have you all broken down because they don't accept you or they don't like you, that sort of thing. At any rate, we'll take a quick commercial break, and then folks have any comments they want to get in about what they heard from Mr. Grimsley, we'll do so, and we'll be back. Just a quick moment, context of white supremacy.
RacismDaily.com, your number one source for global news reports on race, racism, and overt actions of white supremacy. From Asia to the Americas to Europe to Australia to Africa, racism is not a thing of the past. It is our current reality. Be informed. Be globally informed. You should be the first to know. RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Do you need a one-stop shop for all of your multimedia needs? Triumphant Multimedia is a skilled team of professionals with a passion for great marketing and chic design. Our specialties include consulting, brand development, copywriting, and creative graphic design. That's second to none. We also offer photography, photo retouching, videography, and video editing. At Triumphant Multimedia, our goal is to provide highly effective creative solutions built to suit any individual need or budget. Give us a call at 678-732-8067 or check us out online at TRIMultimedia.com.
Context of white supremacy. I will get to the callers. I just wanted to get in really quick. I guess the white governor in Maine, Governor Paul LePage, got in trouble because he was commenting about the war on drugs, and specifically he was commenting about the heroin epidemic, and every single report I have seen without fail has emphasized that this is white people that are doing this, that are shooting up all this heroin and this massive spike. In fact, the report that just came out within the last 2-3 months about the rising numbers what they call middle-class white people, middle-aged, that was what it was, middle-aged white people that are dying and that their life expectancy is dropping. This was one of the things that was listed was drug addiction and particularly use of heroin. But he was talking about all this, and he said, this is a direct quote, he said that he said these guys with the name D-Money, Smoothie, Shifty, these type of guys, they come from Connecticut and New York. They come up here, they sell their heroin, they go back home, LePage told a large crowd. Incidentally, half the time, they impregnate a young white girl before they leave, which is a real sad thing because then we have another issue we have to deal with down the road. All direct quote, fascinating. Cowbell on top of it. And in my view, it is a total lie. The people that are doing all this heroin, both sides, distribution and the usage are overwhelmingly white. And I'm sure Governor LePage knows this. I'm sure he's not in denial. He's just practicing white supremacy racism. Birds chirp, dogs bark, white people terrorize black people. At any rate, if folks have any comments they would like to share from what they heard, they thought information was constructive, they thought it was practicing racism, a little bit of both, feel free to chime in. If you have comments, your line should be open.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
So, Tom Smith, the New York King. Great show, Gus. Thank you. I love when you have white people on. You know, I'm convinced that every 100% of, absolutely no exceptions, all white people are racist. And nothing was said that changed my mind. He was practicing racism several times during the show. I think Lash's questions were excellent about white women's participation. And his response and his lack thereof was very revealing. He said that men carry out the violence, but he never laid out the role that that white female plays. Someone mentioned the election, and you know, when you look at the election, we talk about Trump, but remember that white woman is the most dangerous man or woman on the planet. And that's who he'll be up against. So it's a lose-lose situation. Also think on Roz's question, how he tied in those nine areas of people activity was very good. I think it caught him off guard. And lastly, his answer to the question about the white minority asked by the last female caller was extremely revealing. White people, they can't accept the reality that whites are not the majority race on the planet. And it brought me back to a compensatory calling from probably about at least 2 years ago. It was a clip he played about California. And realizing that whites would not be in the immediate future the majority population of the state of California, they made it illegal to use the word minority. Just so they could take that out the book. They're not going to be the minority. And I'm going to mute my line. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings. This is Rash. Yeah, I agree with everything Thomas Smith in New York just said as far as the guest practicing racism. What I did see, though, or I did remember, was that he briefly did answer the question about the role of the white woman, which I found extremely revealing. What he said was white women set the context for white male aggression. And that took me back to the white women who facilitated the Tulsa, Oklahoma Black Wall Street situation. Like, they just create scenarios for white men to be aggressive towards black people. So and he said he didn't have a long answer. He just said that the white woman sets the context and the white male will then act aggressively. So that kind of spoke to Emmett Till or any of the other situations in which a white woman said a black man sexually assaulted her or whistled at her or looked at her in some sort of way or whatever other excuses that white women or the white women crying. Once a white woman cries, it's form like Voltron time. So I found that fairly revealing. I think I did catch him off guard with the question But I really, just in my research, I've written quite a few essays involving racism and white supremacy. And I just find that white people function like ants, like a super organism. But they function in a racist, white supremacist context, as if they have this neural internet that they all are tuned into. And it's something that I think people of African descent and all non-white people cannot really fathom just how different they are. And I remember hearing Dr. Wilson speaking about white people being angry because black people put them out of Africa. And it just made me think of the fact that black people put them out because they behaved abnormally. Back then, Africans were able to see because we had our own cultures, our own religion, our own family structures, and philosophical ideology. We were able to see that their behavior was alien, and that's why we put them out. So I just found that interesting, and I just think that if Dr. Wilson was alive, oh my gosh, this particular episode is phenomenal, and it speaks to a lot of what Dr. Lauren Bonney talks about. I saw some of what Dr. Bobby Wright discussed in our psychopathic racial personality, and definitely the ISIS papers. I think there was a slew of Dr. Wilson moments throughout this particular broadcast, and I'd like to thank you for having this guest on, and I hope we have him back on. I think he was one of the more open guests. Definitely, I think he gave quite a bit of information, but absolutely, I agree with Thomas that he definitely did practice racism at points throughout the broadcast. Thank you so much, and I'll mute my line.
Other folks have comments they want to make sure they got in.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to mention that I think sometimes it's problematic when we say that white women are not directly or primary actors of violence. I think white women are just as much physically and psychologically violent as white men. Sometimes we shape them, and I think white people do a really good job, like your guests do a really good job at kind of trying to make white women seem innocent or some type of are not aggressive. I think white women are directly and primary actors in violence. That was just a comment I wanted to make.
It's a little bit of for the people that are on the vote line, if you're using your computer microphone, just be aware that it's very sensitive, right? So if you're like shifting, or if you're moving it around, or if you're touching the keyboard or what have you, if you have either a mobile device or an iPad, whatever, that you want to just be very cognizant, because we pick up all that extra noise. But I think the caller's comments, where she was saying that a lot of times white women's role as aggressive racists, violent racists, gets minimized, and that they do the same sort of violent acts on a regular basis. It might not be in terms of what we typically think about in terms of a lynching or a police shooting, that sort of thing, but their racist violence is still enacted against black people in a myriad of fashions. Even remember, I think one of our guests from summer of 2014, where she commented on having which I've emphasized consistently, one of the main forms that this plays out is in the classroom. But at any rate, she was on in 2014, and she said that she had a white female teacher who physically punched her in her head when she was, I don't think, any older than like 5-6 years old. And literally punched her in her head, and she gave a lot more anecdotes of white female aggression in the classroom. But I think that was her point well said. Other folks, anybody we haven't heard from who had comment they want to make sure they got in?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I just found it quite interesting that I asked him a question. You know, if you had all the authority, the power, all the resources basically in the world or the country or wherever the space you want to limit it to, you know, how would you end racism? You know, And of course, you know, the best answer he could come up with was, you know, just, I guess, confront them or something and
therapy.
Get them to, yeah, therapy. And it's like, really? So whenever you guys want to get rid of, I don't know, so-called terrorism when it comes to, you know, quote-unquote, Arabian people that are considered Arabs or whatever, you can mount up all types of laws, you can get all the weapons, you can get whatever you want, and you can get rid of that problem. But all he can come up with was, you know, therapy. And it's just like, you don't have the will to end, you know, white supremacy. And it's, I think you're just playing around, joking, really, to me. So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Greetings, mm-hmm. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I, if it was incorrect to do so, I apologize for it, but, I, kind of like just wanted to listen to the entire, the guests and then, comment, afterwards, because I've heard so many of the, white guests. And I'm not saying I don't like it. I don't like for them to come on. I do like for them to come on, but I've heard so many of them that there's a standard pattern that I observe. I don't know. I don't know about anybody else, but even the white people who seems to have some sort of pride into stating some kind of honesty about racism, they go right up to a point, and then all of a sudden, it's like I'm not an expert with this, or the Area 8 would be I don't talk about my private life. There's some limitations that are not impossible to break through, but that white person makes the choice not to talk about. Therefore, it easily tarnishes the integrity of that white person. Of course, we all know the system of racism and white supremacy automatically questions the integrity of all people who identify themselves as white. You know, who are identified as white, but that's just a point. And also a pattern is they are very reluctant to point out by name and address or phone number or whatever we as non-white victims of racism, white supremacy need to know, white people, including themselves, that practice racism on a daily basis and why and how they do it. And it's just something that I, you know, notice on every time that this type of white person comes on the program. Thank you.
This is Lashes. The fact that the guests suggest, based on my question, that the white female do provide context for the system of white supremacy was very good. I'm glad he said that, because that's what I was hoping he would have said along those lines. And my analogy, he pretty much agreed to in terms of the basketball analogy, as well as how like one team member sets up the layup for the other team member to take the ball and make a shot, and they all benefit as a team, so they all score. So I thought I'm glad he agreed with that analogy as well, to make it more clearer for victims to understand what is really going on.
So anybody that we have not heard from, anybody had a hand up that had something they wanted to make sure they got in, what they heard from the guest, observations, comments, thought? And we got all the folks who had a hand up. Did anybody think anything of him giving this moment that was supposed to be so definitive in his childhood, where he said, "These are not my people"? He's talking about these other racist children in the classroom, and that's followed by him staring down this black male student lustfully. That those are connected in the book, literally, like on the same page. Did that have any significance for any of the folks?
Based on what you just stated, it seems that the guest at the time wants to disassociate himself from his people by saying that they're not his people, identifying them as white supremacists, but yet he himself is one too by acting on lustfully the white gaze onto this victim child. They tend to do that sometimes.
Frequently.
Disassociate, but they're actually associating by their action themselves, but they're disassociating themselves from white supremacists verbally through language, but their action is showing that they are associated. You understand what I'm saying?
Totally.
So that's pretty consistent as far as their patterns are concerned.
I've heard gay white men do this before, sort of like, I think it's a way to, they try to push off that they're not really that racist as a straight white man. We kind of understand, because I think that was sort of what he was playing on. And I think he was lying. I think that for him to have those type of, at a young age in school, in, you know, high school, 15, to look at a black male and be so enticed by him, I could see him definitely, over the course of his 60 years, he dibbled and dabbled, I think, somewhat. And, you know, being a college professor, he has a lot of access as well.
In Atlanta, no less. Emory's in Atlanta, Georgia. I think pretty robust population of black people. And he includes in the book that when he left North Carolina, eventually he went to, you know, college and all that stuff. He went to New Orleans, interestingly, which also has a robust population of black people.
Do you think it's possible that he was actually telling the truth in that regard? But what's the enticing factor is being close in proximity to the victim and having the ability to practice that white gaze and dominance. But the climax is not crossing the line, meaning actual penetration, but just like you're on the border, and that in of itself is the climax of its power or that person's power in under the system of white supremacy. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's not the actual penetration, perhaps, with this person, but it's just like you're on that fine line, and that in of itself is an arousal. It's a climax. It's just like this intensity of you're on the edge, and kind of the equivalent of how people would equate a high of some sort, but not fully engaging, but you're just there, and that's all. It's satisfying for them. Do you understand what I mean?
Absolutely. I definitely think that that certainly could be, particularly with the geographic choices in terms of being in these areas that have a lot of black people. And he even said in the book that he picked New Orleans specifically because he didn't say that because they have a lot of black people. He said because they have for many years had a pretty pronounced what they call gay community, people that, you know, are gay and they're out in the open, and you don't have to be secluded about it. And I think Atlanta also has that reputation, but these cities also happen to have a lot of black people. So I definitely think that could be the case. But I also think it's very possible he could have been not being totally truthful, because I think it was Thomas in New York who asked about the sexual intercourse, if he'd had sexual intercourse with a black male or a black female. And he said, no, I've not had sex with a black female. And he just left it at that. And then when I said, well, he said black male and black female. And he said, well, I'm not accustomed to talking about my private sexual matters. But no, I have not. Mm. I think he could have been not telling us the full truth on that one. Because from the book, Richard Bernstein, The Whole World as the White Man's Brothel, white men and white women, they are not accustomed to just generally being right on the edge. They want the full gusto the full 9 yards of the racist experience. But I totally think what you said is totally logical, and it could be the case. But I also think just based on his response, he might have been lying to us on that one.
Well, how about this? It's both. Let's just say it's both.
Right on. Right
you
on.
You know?
Right on.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I agree. Speaking to what Lashes was just talking about and the question that you asked previously, I thought that that was actually a Welsing moment when he said he's not one of them. It just said to me that he didn't like not having pigmentation, and it was like a Freudian slip, a subconscious slip of the truth, basically, in that moment. And then right after that, he goes into the discussion about the young black male that he was, you know, throwing lustful looks at. And that, to me, looked like the Jeffrey Dahmer moment. It just reminded me of something like, hey, you know, I have to have some chocolate. And it was almost like he was compelled to do it. And I just believe he was on, like, racist autopilot. It's like he because he alluded to the fact that he wasn't fully conscious of what he was doing, which I don't think is necessarily true because he's white, and white people lie all the time. But if that is the case, that speaks to the fact that, to me, that's just what they are, what it means to be a white person. You know, it's just, that's the key to understanding the whole system. Once you understand that, then everything else lines up in a row for you. As far as your understanding, it will grow exponentially once you're able to answer that question. I think that's probably the most important question asked ever. For that reason.
Can I be heard?
Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up, please.
Can I be heard now?
Yes, sir.
Alright, yeah. I found it interesting that he answered the question about, I think, about who's more confused in the system of racism, white supremacy, black people or white people. I found it interesting that he answered that question with lightning speed and expertise. So I felt like that was one of the, no matter how, you know, honest he may have been with us or whatever, when it came to that particular question, it was so natural for him to just say white people because, you know, he was being a racist white supremacist suspect or racist white supremacist. And I also found it interesting that he, you know, said that he wished that he believed in a day of judgment, which meant that accountability in the future. So that means that that he doesn't, and that probably most racist white supremacists don't. But yet they use certain avenues to manipulate the people. And I found it interesting also that, you know, he did acknowledge that racism, white supremacy, for the most part, is going to cling to Christianity and manipulate the people through that. And when I asked about the opposition to other certain religions, he kind of acknowledged that fact, but you know, I found this to be very constructive since he went back into his past, so to say. I don't really think that the event that happened in the classroom right after he said whatever he said and he went in to saying that the black male told him to, you know, whatever, I don't actually think that happened. I think that this is where he's practicing sophisticated racism, white supremacy on us by, you know, saying these words through rhetoric and innuendo and then, you know, basically telling us what he really wants to do and what he really likes, but yet he tried to hide it and say, you know, this is something that happened in the classroom. I think he may have had a confrontation with a black kid or a child, but I don't think those were the words that was exchanged. And that's my final observation.
He was also apprehensive.
Can I be heard?
Suggested that is white supremacy, white culture, too. I thought that was interesting.
The caller in Canada? Yes, we can hear you also.
Oh, okay. Just one thing. One thing that I liked is that when it came to when you brought up the situation with Takai and Is it Takai? Is that how you say it with the Asian gay male? Is it Takai?
I think that's what it is, unless I'm mistaken. I think that's what
okay,
it is.
Okay, well, I'll go with the Takai and Clarence Thomas issue. I think he seemed to, I guess subconsciously, and I kind of like that he didn't make it, you know, the gay as the new black, that he seemed to understand that race was the primary issue there, and I think he understands that white supremacy is the primary order of the world, because I'm not a big fan of this, oh, you know, gays, new black, women. No. I always believe it. The core thing is white supremacy, so I don't like those arguments. So I like that he didn't do that. One thing I did not like is how he approached the interracial question, and specifically dating whites, which I think a couple callers mentioned, interracial relations with whites. I find this often whenever, like, because I've looked at some of your discussions in the archives, but I don't know, have you ever had a white guest who did not avoid the impact of a white supremacist structure on interracial dating for black people or non-white people, a white guest, because I find that they always go into this very sort of individualistic, personalized, you know, people just choose who they want to love, don't see, blah, 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 as if that's not implicated by sociological of society, of, Am I making sense?
I don't think we've ever had a white person on who's acknowledged that truthfully and, you know, given a response that's logical under these conditions about what's incorrect about these tragic arrangements. I think most white people, they generally exactly the same type of rhetoric that you heard from them in terms of, you know, everyone's free to choose. And I'm certainly not going to tell someone who they can be in bed with, and people can have loving relationships and blah, blah, blah. That's pretty typical.
Peggy McIntosh didn't even fall under those guidelines as one person who would agree that's incorrect. And this other guy from the archives, he came on your show twice. A book called Fire Something.
That's a white guy?
yes,
G-rated.
Sorry, my bad. Yes. His first interview with you was excellent. He was very transparent. The second interview with him, he was practicing white supremacy by being coded with his language. I can't fire something is in the title of his book. Burn something. Oh, my God. I think it was in 2009. Oh, man.
And he was on twice, you say?
Yes. Okay. His first interview with you was superb. Second one was awful. Because he was coding. He wasn't answering questions, and he was getting an attitude.
That's pretty common, too. That's pretty common, too. The first one, Peggy McIntosh, I can answer that. No, I don't. And I will say I do not recall totally if someone asked her about sexual intercourse, but I know she did enough of the conflation. It was like we had to fight when asking her questions because she would redirect almost every time to sexism and patriarchy, and, you know, kept having to emphasize that we're not even talking about that. We're talking about white supremacy, and she would just continue to redirect back to sexism. But no, I definitely don't think she would have been one to be the exception to the rule on that. The male, I'm just trying to see if I can remember who you're talking about.
Okay.
Gus, I wanted to say, I think all of the white people that come on the show and try to play that, you know, that role that, oh, people should be free to choose. I think they're just practicing one of the highest, most reformed versions of white supremacy ever. Just looking at the code book, that's exactly what they're doing. They try to present it in a way in which all people are the same. That's the psychology that they use to get us to think, like, oh, you know, it's okay. You know, if I'm black and I happen to fall in love, quote unquote, with a white person, it's okay. That's the language they use. But that's a very, very refined form of white supremacy. Basically, they're telling you, I would love to dominate black people in the bedroom. They're just saying it in the most nice and, you know, most comforting way, and makes it seem like how they perpetuate these things in the media, and how just about every TV show has some form of miscegenation sorts of relationships all over, whether it's homosexual ones or heterosexual ones, is just everywhere. So when they speak that way, in my opinion, they're just practicing the most refined form of racism, white supremacy, and they're presenting it to you in a way in which the wolf did when he dressed up as Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah, I think white people, they're not ignorant. That is not the problem. They're very clear, and I think they have an understanding of how what happens in the bedroom has long-term implications that are in their favor for this happening, and just indulging their racist fetish for sexually violating black people. I think they are very well-versed with all that. John Hopewell, fire was it? Dr. John Hoberman was on the program in 2009. He's a white person. He was on twice, but I don't think fire is in any of his book titles.
Fire burning.
Or burning.
I think this is South Carolina, North Carolina, somewhere in the South. Oh, man. If I find it, I'll remember to recall. I could bring it up again.
Okay. I guess in the meantime, anybody, anything else they want to make sure they get in before we wrap things up? Anything stand out? Thought it was important.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to say I found it interesting how after, you know, the discussion or the questions that he answered, when I asked him, is there anything that he would suggest non-white people do to not be mistreated, he had not one really real suggestion. And it just further proved that, you know, he was practicing racism, in my opinion. And out of all the guests, I think when I asked the question, who's more confused, we've had just one since I've asked that question, and that was the non-white, non-black female guest that you had a couple weeks ago who said that non-white people are more confused, but I thought it was interesting how fast he answered that. It was very definite, and it was just a bunch of bull, but thanks for taking my call.
For sure, for sure. Absolutely. They get very definitive. It's no guesswork, no ignorance, no uncertainty. No, I'm not an expert on the who is more confused about white people. Definitely. Absolutely. I've studied it, got all the information. White people are super confused. And particularly this guest, given everything that he said about the nursery rhymes and 3- and 4-year-old whites practicing racism and the little ditties and what have you, and 11-year-old white guy in a wheelchair with I hate niggers scratched on some cardboard. But somehow they are ignorant. They are confused, unaware of all of this. That is total nonsense. Even when he admitted one of the points Mr. Fuller makes all the time, that other white people, you will get in, if you're white, you will get in trouble with other white people if you are ignorant about racism. And he has anecdotes to substantiate that in the book, and he agreed immediately and said, absolutely, that is the truth. You will get in trouble with other white people if you're ignorant. Just right in your face, the contradictions. One question I do wish I had asked him before he departed in terms of how black people respond to his book. I did think it was important. I think our call in Michigan, she asked him who he wrote this book for, and he said he wrote it for white people. I would be curious as to how black people typically respond to him, like when he goes out to do talks or if they read his book or whatever, they hear him on the radio, how black people respond to him, because I think it would be the same type of Timothy Wise, Dr. Peggy McIntosh effect, like, oh my gosh, Mr. Grimsley is the greatest white guy and sharing all of this, and you do understand, and particularly when he can throw the gay aspect in there as well, that I'm a gay white man, so I'm not really like the rest of the white people, and I know about oppression. I think that's the impression that I got just watching the C-SPAN presentation, because there were black and white people present, and it seemed, I'm speculating, but it seemed like that was the type of reception, like, wow, this white guy, and it was a white guy and a white girl that were presenting, so, wow, these white people, this is great. And, you know, it did not seem to be an air of suspicion, like, yeah, this guy's a racist, this white girl is a racist, I'm going to regard them. It did not seem that way at all, and I suspect that would be the pattern for black readers of his book and black people that, you know, hear him or see him give a presentation. We basically did our three. Anything folks feel like they need to get in quickly before we wrap? Folks satisfied?
Quickly,
go ahead.
I'll go ahead.
Your volume is very, very low, Thomas, in New York. It's like hard to hear you.
I was going to say just real quickly, the most avoided question seems to be always the jokes. You know, can you tell us some of the jokes? I asked him, can you tell us some of the nursery rhymes? He just went back to the one in his book. You know, I remember all the nursery rhymes from when I was a kid. You know, you don't know you remember them till you have kids yourself, and then you end up, you know, singing all of them. So I just think that was definitely after racism, and I can't remember any guest that really just came out and told us some of the jokes and things.
Me either. That's another another big pattern for I too have observed when white people, even when they say I grew up around white people and they told racist jokes, he says it, my dad, my uncle, all these people at church, yep, nigga this, nigga that, nigga joke this, blah, blah, blah. Can't remember a one. I got amnesia, Alzheimer's, or set. I can't remember a one. That has been my experience pretty much every time. I think even when I've been talking to white people, like face-to-face talking to white people, it's been the same pattern. I only recall one that was different, and even that had an asterisk because I had asked once publicly, and he didn't say anything, and then it just happened that I bumped into this guy again privately, where it was just us, and he said, oh, yeah, I do remember some racist jokes, and he started going ahead and spilling them left and right. But, yeah, that's been the pattern that I've seen consistently.
I have a comment.
Go ahead. Firefighter, go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was just about to say to the conversation that's going on now is, for the most part, white people like the one who just was interviewed today, they don't get questions. They don't get a whole lot of questions from non-white black people. I listen to a lot of programs, live as well as on the computer, and this program by far is not even close. Asks the most questions to white people, more so than any other program that I've listened to. And for the most part, white people that go around, especially in front of black people, they're quite comfortable with the idea that instead of questions are going to be asked, you get a whole lot of statements that come from us, for the most part. And most of those statements, when a white person says what this guy says, it's complimentary, directly or indirectly, excuse me, to that white person, as opposed to some deep intrinsic questions and staying focused for the most part. I don't really hear it on. So that's basically what quote unquote we encounter, those of us who are consistently on this program, get from these white people. They get real uncomfortable when they come on this program because there's a lot of questions that get thrown at them. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, to add to what that last caller said, I said that's one of the things that draws me to your show is that, like, here in Canada, like I know black people globally, there's confusion, but if I had to put, like, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being really high confusion, I would say, I would guess African-Americans, black people in the States are, like, 7.5. I would say black people in Canada are like 9. And that's one of the things I noticed. They're not used to black people or other non-white people, especially black people. I think there's a different response when it comes from black people. If they're hearing audio, they suspect it's a black person. It's very different. Like, they get very antsy. That's one of the things I actually do notice as well. So I think that's also different. I especially noticed this because I went back in the archives and I listened to your discussions with Tim Wise, and you are completely, I'm not even saying this to, you know, be whatever. Anytime I've seen from scholars, regular people on YouTube ever discuss Tim Wise, it is in a white Jesus way. And other whites that do this too. It's very white Jesus-y. Like the other day I got in a Facebook argument about why I don't think white gays, not even because they're gay, but because they're white, should not be adopting children. You have some person of color saying, oh, well, blah, 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 confused stuff. And don't really want it. Anytime, it's like anytime a white person gives us a little, like, crumb, we think it's like gold. It's like we're in love with white mediocrity. It's like our state is that bad. So that's one thing I like about your callers, all of them. Like, I love sometimes just listening to podcasts just to hear your callers that are actually critical and talk to white people properly. Like, two of our public people over here in Canada, so Tambra Anderson and Rochelle DeCoste, they talk exactly like that with white people, and they're considered by white people here in Canada to be the wicked witches of the East and West. So it's funny how this pattern reoccurs all the time. And I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. It's our last comment.
Okay. I just wanted to say when I asked him what was the age of the youngest people he had ever heard or seen practice racism, and he said 3 or 4. That to me just said they're born that way. And I remember, I think it was Jessica Pettit, who basically said she was racist from the womb. So it's just further confirmation that it's just in their genetic code to function this way. Thank you. That's all I wanted to say.
That was pretty prominently said at the White Privilege Conference. She was at the White Privilege Conference that I attended, but she was on the program before we got to that point in the road. But that was prominently said, like white people saying that they were racist from the moment of conception. Was the way that they phrased it. And this was like not controversial. It was not disputed. It was like, So I do put that on the table for folks to keep in mind. And even as I said in the book, he had passages that said that, you know, he had some of this understanding in terms of how he's supposed to function as a white supremacist. It was like pre-memory, as though this had already been programmed in terms of how he's supposed to think, speak, act, feel as a white person from, you know, before the time that he was even born. So I just put that out there for folks to consider when making our assessment of whites. With that, we will be back tomorrow, same program time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, the book club, week 5, Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told. We had all of the gruesome detail about how whites refined and improved their methods of torture and violence against black people to better control us during formal plantation enslavement. Picking up from where we left off last week, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Looking forward to the book club tomorrow evening. And then obviously Saturday we'll be here for the compensatory call-in. I think it's Monday. Ms. DeCoste should be on the program since she was just mentioned. We'll have more people from north of the states visiting the program, but that should be Monday. Anywho, if you have questions, problems, gripes, complaints, nutty ideas, feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. And guest suggestions, too. I prefer to get them at Gmail because it's better to be organized. It's easier for me to organize them there. If you send them on Facebook, I mean, that's fine. But Gmail would be preferred because I can organize and, you know, really make sure that I'm on task. Sometimes it takes a while. Lashes made the suggestion in November. It took January to make it happen. So you have to be patient sometimes. But email would be best. With that, I will again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. If you're going to be driver, passenger, pedestrian, you do not want to be under the influence. If you should happen to bump into Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, you really want to be in your correct mind where you are lucid, clear thinking so you can make the best possible decisions to take care of yourself, family members, anybody else that you might be responsible for. Particularly, you do not want to be in the presence of intoxicated whites. It can go from zero to lethal in a matter of seconds. We've done programs to document this, particularly with this environment, where it's just been fueled. I even thought of that today. Like, they have all these articles where they are training and encouraging aggression. Like, the new thing is, if there's some sort of terrorist attack, don't run, pull out your gun and go to work. Like, they have classes on this that they're promoting and talking about it. I've been seeing this for weeks now, where they're saying that's like the new in vogue thing. Like, I'm not running, I'm standing my ground and I'm ready to go to work. And I can totally see that. Oh, I thought, you know, it was black. I thought this was a terrorist. I thought, you know, they had come here to do us some harm. So, you know, I did my training. That's what they taught us in the class. Man, be alert, Be mindful of things that are happening around you. And again, you do not want to be around whites who are intoxicated in this environment. It just could be really bad. And I would even encourage, if you know, you don't want to be around too many non-white people that are under the influence either. It's just an environment rife with poor decision making and conflict. And we already got enough problems as black people to deal with under the system of white supremacy. That said, the memorial, again, it'll be on Saturday, Dr. Francis Kress Welsing, on the campus of Howard University. It's going on for hours, it seems like, for Saturday. So if you're in the D.C. area or think you can be there by Saturday, go ahead and attend campus of Howard University. I'll be looking to hear from folks who make the trip, and hopefully it is something worthy of the time and energy Dr. Welsing invested in trying to help us solve this problem. We are fundraising for 216. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. Listener supported counter racist radio. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested and supported us over the years. Hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. As Dr. Welsing would say, it is an exercise in black mental health to abstain from squabbling, bickering with other black people. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice. Immediately, Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.